Good morning and welcome to the August 7th, 2023 meeting of the Chelan Public Utilities Commission. I'd like to check everybody to check their electronic devices to make sure that they're placed on the silent mode to assist in not disrupting today's meeting. And we do value public input at our meetings. We've got a good attendance today. I don't know if there's any members of the public in the audience for sure, but we'll find out probably at some point. And we will be providing an opportunity for the public to have input at the end of our morning session and at the end of the afternoon session. If you wish to speak, we ask that you provide your name and address for the record, as our meetings are recorded and we wish to have an accurate record of your input. We additionally ask that you limit any comments to 3 minutes. Additionally, if you wish to speak to any of the agenda items today, I'll provide that opportunity at the end of each segment. Our flag salute and safety minute today will be brought to us by Kristen Lodge.
We'll start with the flag salute. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning. I'm Kristen Lodge, Visitor Services Manager out at the Rocky Reach Discovery Center. Hope everyone's doing well this morning. I'm here with your safety minute. Some of you may know that I'm a hometown girl. I was born and raised here in Wenatchee. I lived in Seattle and Portland in the Pacific Northwest for about 12 or 15 years. And when I moved back, I made a vow that I would never complain about Wenatchee traffic. But I found a loophole in that, and that's the topic of our safety discussion here today. Here's a picture of beautiful Wenatchee Valley to remind me what I love about this place, right? We're going to talk about roundabouts, and specifically, we're going to talk about Wenatchee drivers and roundabouts.
I hope you
can I record this for my wife?
A lot of time.
Now, really, I blame a lack of experience. So just briefly, I know you got to talk about this in the spring, but there's a lot of benefits of roundabouts. Mostly, you need to be paying attention, right? So you're going slow. If there are accidents or mishaps, they're happening at a very slow rate of speed, which prevents those major incidents. We're not talking T-bones here, right? We're talking slow speed fender benders. We're going to talk a little bit about safety. Now, this is a recap from the spring in single lane, but then we're going to move to multi-lane. So just a review of the safety minute, slow down, look left and yield, enter when you see a gap in traffic. Now, I know we all know this, but as a PSA, we're going to share this information with our friends. Do not stop if you can prevent it. Just don't do it. Look for a gap, you know, move when you can. Use your turn indicators, your blinkers. They're fair game in that roundabout. Go ahead and turn them on when you're going to use them. But here's the challenge we received recently. The single lane, I think we got that, right? We can handle that. Multi-lane roundabouts. Wenatchee, what are we thinking? So we've got Easy Street. We're going to use those same guidelines. We're going to pause and slow down. We're going to yield to the left. One of the pro tips I've learned by maneuvering that Easy Street roundabout every morning and afternoon as I go to and from Rocky Reach is never to change lanes. Use the lane you want to use before entering the roundabout and then stay in that lane. Look left. One of the things I've noticed about that is that we're seeing pedestrian intersections on both sides. So you're looking left to traffic, but you may have a pedestrian entering from the right. So it's still important to know what's going on around you at all times. Enter in that gap in traffic, signal the exit. One of the things I see a lot out at that Easy Street roundabout and that concerns me and that I wanted to talk about today is it's next to that high industrial fruit area where there's a lot of semi-trucks moving through there. And I think we've all seen semi-trucks move through roundabouts. They're using that truck apron to go straight through the roundabout. But in those multi-lanes, there's a lot of drivers that aren't aware of what's happening to the right or left of them in the other lane. So making sure to give those trucks a wide berth as you move through. And then again, looking for those bikers and pedestrians. Thank you for the opportunity to deliver this safety minute this morning. Hope everyone has a good day. Drive safely.
Thank you, Kristen. Any questions or comments from commissioners?
Kristen, I have to jump in here.
Oh, please do, yeah.
I have to share that, yes, the speed limit in a roundabout is supposed to be slow enough that if you do have a contact with another vehicle, it should just be minor. Although my brother-in-law found a way to total his car in the roundabout. And that's the kind of unusual one in East Wenatchee, was you're coming across the bridge where you...
Oh, sure.
You go into the roundabout, or you can take a Y, and it says yield. Well, he forgot to yield.
Sure.
So it can happen.
Roundabout 101.
Yes, and he's from a big city. He should know better.
He should have had more experience, right?
Exactly, right.
So, yeah. You know, I first was introduced to roundabouts 20-plus years ago in England, and I learned, I was driving there, and I learned to love them because, I mean, you're on the wrong side of the road going the wrong way anyway, so, it helped me be less confused. The question I always have, and you spoke to it just now, is as you're entering a roundabout, is there any school of thought that you're aware of that could say, maybe in a few words, yield to the left, because we are so ingrained and trained to yield the right of way, not the left of way. Is there any conversation about that with signage?
Gosh, not that I'm aware of, although I have to admit I was excited to use the roundabout when it first opened, when it first opened, I was thinking, no one else is here. It's just me, right? It's the crack of dawn. I'm headed out to Rocky Reach. Let me look at all this signage and make sure I understand what lane I need to be in before everyone's using it with me. That's a really good point. That's maybe the takeaway we need is yield to the left, right?
You know, and I don't know if it would be our Department of Transportation to evaluate with all these roundabouts going in. The fundamental mind shift is yield to the left. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from a safe, you know, and I know what you mean by don't stop in the roundabout if you can avoid it. Thank you.
For my peace of mind, at least. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Great topic.
Yes.
Great topic.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
There is that song, Randy.
What?
To the left, to the left.
Okay, item two is the approval of the agenda, and management has recommended that we can move potentially resolution number 13 to the consent agenda. Would that meet with everybody's approval?
Absolutely.
Hearing no objection, we will consider that done. You know, one of the things that I, all of a sudden, it just now hit me that I made in my opening remarks, I skipped a line. There's, for the record and the recording, there are four commissioners present today, and Commissioner McKenna has been excused, and our regular staff of Kirk Hudson, General Manager, Eric Walquist, General Counsel, and Rebecca Newman, Clerk of the Board, are all here with us. So just wanted to complete the record, the recorded record. So if there's no objection on the agenda, we'll have it adjusted for when we get to the consent agenda. Item three, CPO recognition.
Yep, I'd like to invite Casey Hall and John Laycock up to the front table here. So Casey Hall and John Laycock were both nominated for a Cycle of Personal Ownership Award, and it was for their just fantastic work they did leading the construction of all the facilities out at Rocky Reach. And I know you've all been out there, you've seen the job well done, and it was not without significant challenges. This all happened during a pandemic. It also, when you're replacing buildings that are 70 years old with new buildings and functions, it's quite a challenge to get around to make sure everything's going to work for all the work groups that are being relocated to these new facilities. And that's first and foremost what Casey and John were nominated for, was their planning and coordination work. I know both of them are very capable of building buildings. It's all the other things that have to happen that they are extremely good at, and we're recognized for this effort too. So just want to say thank you to both of you. Just extremely big challenge and a job well done. And you both rose to the challenge and are being recognized by your peers for doing so. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Care to share any thoughts?
Yeah, it was a great experience for John and I. We couldn't have done it without the CM, Central Maintenance Team, EPM. We had great stakeholders. Wes, Jessica, Tony, all helped. You know, they pitched in when we had things trying. You know, what was unique to this project was we always were moving into new buildings and moving people out of old buildings. We didn't get the opportunity to just have a site for ourselves and just build the whole thing and say, okay, move in. So a lot of challenges there, and just having that group, that team really there to help move us in, be that helping hand with their equipment, really being proactive and planning, really made it a great experience. And that goes for the design side too. I mean, now that they're in the facility, they're working in a facility that they designed, that they saw working in, and you see their excitement. I wouldn't say excitement, let's say gratitude for the district investing in that facility for that work group. So you can see it on their faces every day.
Yeah, definitely. You can see that they're excited to work in their new facility. So I walk through the building constantly and I'm getting praise. Hey, thanks for the facility. So it's nice to see everybody using it.
Yeah. Right. So they appreciate the investment you made in their that work group in that facility.
Well, my experience is just that, you know, I saw what was there before, and now all of a sudden it's there. You know, for me, the change was instantaneous, and I can also say the enthusiasm within the workers that are there and all the employees is a positive feedback all the time and with the facility, and to me, I think you guys did a great job in. Addressing the needs of the district. So thank you very much for your service and what you've done for the utility. Good job.
Thank you.
And for me, I can say I don't know the prior. So it's been fantastic, though, seeing, again, the enthusiasm that everybody has. And I, as you were being recognized, I actually had a moment where of kind of a surprise because, and this is coming out a little, I hope it comes out correctly. I have been nothing but impressed by our entire team. And so in some ways, you know, I guess maybe I'm jaded in a good way because to be recognizing you seems so right. And I couldn't imagine it any differently because, Casey, I've met you a couple times and just the confidence and the commitment to excellence that you have that I see within the entire district is something that I'm very proud of. And so thank you for continuing and being part of that.
Thank you. Last comment from me is I'm always struck, and today is absolutely no different, when winners for being recognized or honored here in the boardroom, and you come up and share with us what's going on. And neither one of you leapt at taking the credit for what happened. You said, we've got a great team out there that worked together and made this happen. And I really, really appreciate and respect that we're all focused on helping each other and lifting the entire organization through teamwork. So thank you so much.
Thank you both. Job well done.
Thank you.
Yep. Good job.
Yep. Yep. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Item 4.
Yep. More recognition this morning.
That's cool.
Yay.
That's good.
Yeah. So I'd like to invite Annika Kallstrom, and is Hardy here? Hardy is not here. Okay. Darn. Hopefully we'll catch him.
Okay.
Can you see if you can come up at some point? Recognize Annika. And I'll recognize Hardy after Annika in case he's not able to make it. But Annika and Hardy there were both recognized as young leaders from the Wenatchee World's 30 Under 35 Business Journal. And I have to say, the 30 awardees that were recognized, if you look at the latest Business Journal, very impressive backgrounds, experience, and leaders in what they do. And so we had two of our own there out of the 30, and it was a ceremony last week that I was able to attend, and just grateful to be able to attend to hear all the stories behind them. So I'm just going to share a little bit about Annika. She's part of the Energy Planning and Trading Systems team. She supports the traders by ensuring they have the data they need to make well-informed trading decisions. She acts in her role as a project manager. One of the recent projects was the implementation of a new system called the Chelan Interchange Tool. It was launched earlier this year. And it manages critical energy accounting data and is used across multiple departments at the PUD. And in the summer of 2019, this is a shout out for our intern program. She interned at Rocky Reach as an electrical engineering student from Oregon Institute of Technology, and we hired her in 2020 as a business technology analyst in energy resources. She's an avid reader who enjoys the outdoors, and her and her husband Josh live in East Wenatchee. And I also heard at that ceremony that she was part of a national championship cross-country team. And yeah, so when it says avid runner, very avid. Wow. So, Annika, congratulations, and thanks for representing the district so well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well deserved.
Yeah. Congratulations.
You're in a very impressive small group of elite, the 30 under 30, and you've done just wonderful things already in your short tenure here. I'm so excited to see what's next. I know that there are more great things about you for your future ahead of you. Thank you for being part of our team and representing us so well.
Thanks. It's an honor. I'm really thankful for the team I'm part of. It's made working here at the district a real joy. I was thinking over the weekend, I was working out in the yard, and I was thinking, man, I feel like one of the things that Chelan Beauty does really well is empowering people. And, you know, from the first day when you're going through new hire orientation and you're reminded, like, anyone at any level can stop work. You have that authority, you know, to promote safety. And then, you know, that's on the first day, and then everything from there, it's like, you know, I feel really empowered in my role to do the best that I can, use my best judgment, like thinking through the lens of how can we serve our customer owners as well as we possibly can. And so I'm really thankful for the team because I think it's unique to be at an organization that empowers people so well. So I'm really grateful.
So, Annika, I have the opportunity over the last several years to become fairly close personal friends with three other 30 under 35 winners over the last several years, and to be absolutely delighted to see what the path forward could hold for you if you choose to take the mantle and run with it, because I know what they've got, and I'm betting that you've got every bit as much, and the world is your oyster, as they say. So I'm looking forward to hearing about great things from you going forward.
Thank you. No pressure.
Well, one of the things that struck me was just how much Annika and the others have done already. I mean, it's just remarkable. It's stunning. So, yeah.
I might add that two of those three, 30 under 35, actually have traveled with me to a little country in Central Asia called Kyrgyzstan.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
So I'll just put that on your radar.
I see a future invite, huh?
It's already started. Kyrgyzstan intern program.
Wow. the radar.
You can talk to Bob Bauer about the dam they have on the Naren River that generates a comparable amount of electricity to Rocky Reach.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. So, thank you again.
Thanks, Annika. Yeah, I think we'll hold off on Hardy until he can make one of the meetings.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Great
idea. Yeah, good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Or in case he shows up later.
Okay. Quarterly district performance plan update.
I think Justin will lead us off here. This is our quarterly review of the district performance plan. We're going over initiatives and projects that have changed status since the first quarter report.
Great. Good morning, commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director for District Services. Happy to lead off this morning with the first one here under one, commit to the highest level of customer owner satisfaction. About halfway down, advance customer experience by completing the customer experience plan for the service center. Opening by end of quarter two. That's marked as needs attention. However, I'm pleased to report that we hope to finish that work by the end of June. We finished a draft, and in the review of the draft, we identified some amendments that could be made to better serve the group going forward and make sure that we best serve the public, including the establishment of a customer service team that will review feedback and implement changes on an ongoing basis after the facility is open to the public. So that's part of the reason for the delay, but that plan will be wrapped up here in the next week or two, well in advance of the public opening in October.
Good morning, commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. I have the next one at the top of number two, invest in creating long-term value. We had an objective to recommend a new service, electric service reliability target, and we put that in the context of looking at similar situated utilities. So there was a small team of us, did quite a bit of benchmarking, put together an analysis, and actually have prepared those targets, and probably over the next month you'll see that brought forward to the commission for consideration. So that's complete.
I've got the next one, which is identify public entities and our trade associations for potential partnerships. We've identified four core areas there, including wildfire mitigation, dam safety, second water source, and broadband expansion. That is marked as a caution simply because we're haven't settled on a particular partnership or opportunity to date, but we are ready and agile and ready to exercise those partnerships as they become available and continue to work with legislative and agency partners across the state.
Brett Bickford, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. I have the next one, Rocky Reach C11. That project was delayed multiple years. We went ahead and started the disassembly of that unit while we were negotiating with Voith on a contract revision for all the work that they had to do in the shop. In the second quarter, we finally executed that field work order. And because of heavy shop loading by Voith, they were not able to maintain the same contract terms, and so we did negotiate with them. But that's putting us several months later on being able to return that runner back to Rocky Reach. The next item is our U5 rehabilitation that's going on at Powerhouse 2. In the planning phase, it was determined that quite a few new disassembly tools would need to be manufactured to remove that runner, because that runner hasn't been removed since it was installed back in the late 70s. Unfortunately, GE's encountered some delays in having some of those new tools manufactured. And so we've identified that because of that, the unit will be disassembled a couple months later than what was planned, unfortunately. Our U3 modernization, there's really no change since the quarter one report. That unit was delayed due to a new contractor performing discharge liner work. But that unit is in our control now with central maintenance doing the reassembly work. That's going well, so we haven't had any additional schedule slippage. But that will be returned to service, we project, in about Q1 24. The next one's our B6 turbine repair. That unit is the work's being completely done by CM. That unit's probably going to come back a little bit late. It's in caution status. But what we identified is we're seeing more concrete growth issues. We were planning that about every third overhaul, so about every 12 years, we would probably have to do unit realignment. And what that means is we've got the turbine is operating in a discharge ring, and the stator is in another circle above it. And we saw just after 4 years that those two circles are misaligned, and so the unit would be operating in a slightly out of plumb alignment. And so we couldn't identify that till we took the unit completely apart. So we identified that, and we spent about 13 weeks realigning that stator. Fortunately, we built that with adjustable sole plates so we could actually move the stators. They weren't like that originally. And so now that unit's realigned, and CM is putting that unit back to work, back together.
So will that probably hold true with as you do other units?
It could be. So, yep, in the successive units, we plan additional time to do unit realignment.
Okay, I've got the next one, which is related to moving into the new service center. We are just at a key time right now as we wrap up odds and ends and begin our move into that facility, targeting the your first commission meeting as October 2nd, which would be when the facility would open to the public as well. So if my math is right, you have three more board meetings in this facility here, and then you'll be transitioning over to the new building. So that is marked caution just because it's a large effort to move hundreds of people into the new building. We have a closely aligned schedule that we're monitoring, and certainly hope to stay on track. But there's always the potential that that we may need to make minor adjustments. But I think we're pretty solid on that October 2nd date.
Seems way out there until he puts it in terms of number of meetings left here.
Right? It's much shorter then, doesn't it?
Yeah. And the strategic play behind that, I applaud you. Got
to
be crazy.
Commissioners, I have the next one. This is another complete item. This has to do with wildfire mitigation and the planning efforts that have gone on to date. This is a two-part goal, and the first one was the outline that was completed. So this one was looking at some recommended mitigations and action items. So that has been put forward, and we'll now move into the next phase of business planning in conjunction with budget. So you'll see more on that.
Good morning, Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer. I'm taking you to the top of page 5 with reporting on 7A being complete of receiving our clean financial audit opinion. And this is one that's a recognition to the whole organization to be able to achieve this one. Takes everyone all the way from that first step of recording your time on your timesheet, right? So it gets to the right place in the financial reporting all the way to applying brand new governmental accounting standards to our organization. So would like to report on this one with the recognition of the achievement of the whole organization.
So, Kelly, before you leave and may not have this chance again, you know, for years and years, I've harassed you privately about us having our credit rating as high as the United States government. I don't know how you got Fitch to downgrade the U.S. to reach us, but
my job is now complete.
Hello, I'm Jared Watts, Safety Director and Director of Human Organizational Performance for the district. Just to go through some of ours on this, if you look at 6.1b, we've got it as needs attention. This is the business units closing out corrective actions or initiating corrective actions within 90 days. And the reason that I've marked this as red is that we need to do a lot of work on our process, our tool that actually tracks the process from the time it was initiated to the time it's closed out. And that's where my team and I are spending a lot of our focus and energy on. That's why that one's marked as red. If we go down to 6.1f, this is marked as red. This is our days away and restricted duty rate. It's at 1.62 right now. With our target was 1.05. We had three restricted duty injuries in the last quarter, and that's why that number is the way that it is. If we go to 6.2b, This is around the safety management system, and the reason for this one being marked as red is it really has to do a lot with my staff vacancies. I've got a lot of vacancies within my staff, and getting to the point where we can get staffed up so that we can further our work on this. Our primary focus is getting there first. So if we go to the next page on 6.3A, and that is for the same reason that one is marked as red, is around staff development and filling those vacancies. And then the last one we marked as red was 6.3C. We had a goal of getting 10 learning sessions or 10 learning teams done throughout this year, both proactive and reactive learning teams. And we're going to be working on shifting that focus to more operational learning that happens, and less just on getting these 10 learning teams. So it's happening more organically and consistently throughout the organization. But thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. Ian Fitzgerald, Chief Technology Officer. I've got five of the next six before I start. These are all good things, and I want to actually focus your attention on the technical teams, the managers, and the directors who've actually been really aligned and committed to these district priorities. They're really the reason why we've been successful this first half of the year. So at 7.2A, focus on the mobile data device management. We now have in the district the capability of delivering tablet technology to our field staff. We are actually using iPads as that technology, and allows us to have the seamless and same experience whether inside the offices or dams or outside in the field. We are going into a beta phase of now putting this in the hands of people and looking at different types of software we can use with it. But from a hardware perspective, securing and having that technical capability is now something we have here at the district.
Have we overcome the challenges that historically have baffled us, a different term, but iPad being an Apple product, the district being a Microsoft-based organization?
We believe we have.
Cool.
Yeah. Now, we're still learning, but we believe we've overcome that challenge.
That's great.
Yeah. On 7.2B, this project was cautioned at the beginning of the year. We were back on track. In fact, not only are we back on track, we've had 9 RFP responses. We had a diverse district team across all of the business units look at the field software that we could use. This field software is designed for looking at assets, asset management, troubleshooting, and actually will help improve the performance and the efficiency of our teams in the field. We've actually reduced that down to 3 vendors right now, and we will have a selection of this vendor at the beginning of September, and start developing end of this year, beginning of next year, and hopefully have our first version of it sometime late summer, early fall of next year.
I got a question on the software. My question is the training of individuals that use the software, is it more simplified or is it more complicated?
The first thing is
how easy is it
to do a single software instead of multiple softwares to help improve the training and reduce increase the familiarity with the software on a daily basis. So the more you use that similar software daily, inside out, you will get much more familiar. We will be putting change management processes and training into the rollout of the software. So really working with the staff and making sure they are comfortable in using this technology is important. Otherwise, it's really not a value. So that is something we are looking at.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, something I just might add, it's really interesting, is one of the main clients of that software, a lot of the younger workforce that's come in, they're like, when can we have this?
Oh, okay.
It's really cool to see that because they see it elsewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Really help them in that
it's
job.
Something that's easy for them to, you know, to get into and transfer.
Maybe knowledge. Train us.
Well, no, that's hopeless. But anyway,
old John.
Yeah, that's a good point, John. The young folks like that stuff. That's true.
And the third one, 7.3A, we have completed the GIS strategy document, and this is now going to help us support the project planning for 2024. We are looking at actually converting our GIS data into what is called the ESRI UN model. That model will give us AI capabilities of tracing and performance within our networks. And so being able to actually look at what can happen in the field first in the model before we actually go and enact it in the field. Hmm.
Brett Bickford again. to report on 7-4A. And so we've completed this activity for assessing our cultural readiness and reviewing procedures and developing a definition of innovation by the end of the year. And so now we're working on the second part of that. We'll be sending out an all-employee communication, kind of providing an update of what we learned from that and what the next steps are.
7-5A, this is another project that we completed this first half of the year. This is our first major step into the cloud, where we moved our data warehouse from on-premise into the cloud, a product called Snowflake. Not only do they have the software set up, but they also have the data pipelines from our systems internally to that environment, both in batch and real-time data movement. Our focus now is actually trying to build out both dashboards with the beta team under Kelly, as well as getting data out there to really start facilitating the use of data and analyzing data in a simpler environment that we've had in the past. So this was not this was a complicated project they put together, but really did a good job in getting it out quickly. And then lastly, on 7-6A, we've completed our Oracle Cache to Meter, or CIS, cloud migration analysis. The reports come back. It says we have two potential paths to go down. Both paths will actually save the district money and actually help us recover capacity of existing staff members. We are in the process of trying to make a decision by the end of the year now of what path we should be going down.
Good morning, Commissioners. Bob Shane, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. I have at the bottom of the page number 8, foster a culture of serving the public interest. I have the first item there, number 1. Happy to report that the team worked really hard in the last quarter to bring that to our hitting our second quarterly objective on the PPP program. Truly a team effort and all the different people involved in that. As you'll see there, we have running totals at Q1, 2, 3. 2, 3, and 4. We do anticipate challenges getting those numbers as we go forward for Q3 and Q4. We're seeing supply chain issues starting to pop up once again. We have resource capacity challenges as well as coexisting priorities. So we're doing our best to manage all the resources and the materials to make sure that we're hitting our targets, but it remains to be a challenge in hitting the overall objective of the PPP program for the 1331 for the end of the year. But no one's given up. We're doing a lot of hard work try to get materials ordered up as early as possible.
So on your supply chain problems, is it you have to reach out farther with greater orders or increase your orders so that we have an inventory of that kind of? How are you addressing that?
Well, we try to forecast the materials needed going forward and get those as early as possible. What happens is materials that weren't necessarily in short supply or were readily available are now becoming delayed. A lot of it's due to our make-ready work. So we're doing, as a PPP program, we're doing some large infrastructure changes, improvements in our make-ready work related to the electrical. So we're seeing poles, power poles being delayed and materials for the electrical stuff. So it sprinkles throughout the program, and any one thing can slow us down.
So, I mean, are we requesting greater inventory? I mean, your orders are probably increased so that you maintain a...
That's correct. Yeah, we increase orders, but we're seeing the lead times growing. A lot of materials are 50, 60, 80 weeks in the materials.
Really?
We're trying to anticipate that and get as early as possible.
Okay.
And there's a concern of obsolescence or change in the need for the materials? Does that make sense?
No. Relative to the asset life, we're fine on the materials in terms of the absolutely being appropriate for the project and the program.
I don't envy you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Continue.
Commissioners, I have the next one. This item is under the heading of Complete Selected Public Power Benefits Projects. You might recall at a parks update earlier this year, we talked about the Walla Walla Point Park Sport Court project that will alleviate the conflict that we have with pickleball and allow additional space for activities to occur. And this one is also related to the next one, which is the Riverfront Park project. And so you'll see both of them actually say on track, but it really should be noted that they're on track with sort of a revised schedule. And so you'll see the note there, waited for better bidding conditions under the sport court project. As we were designing the project and working on the Riverfront Park project, we also realized that we have a parking lot rebuild effort at the Northeast parking lot at Walla Walla, and that all three of those projects are similar type work and would be an attractive package to a contractor. And that could save resources on our side, as well as result in better financial bidding climate.
But the parking, are we increasing our spaces with this remodel, or are we just upgrading what we already have in existence? Because parking is always an issue everywhere you go. I would think that we would try to increase capacity over time.
We certainly do look for opportunities. We look for opportunities, particularly with adjacent parcels that might come up for sale. In this particular case, this is a rebuild of the existing parking lot, okay, and the footprint does not change, so we're not gaining any additional spaces.
Okay.
So all three of those projects will be bid together late this year or early in 2024 for a late winter, early spring construction start. And we will provide a more comprehensive parks update this fall. And so we'll talk about these projects and other major park efforts in greater detail then.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Hey, Commissioners, John again. I'll close it out with the last item to report on, and this is a completion in regard to a feasibility for the regional second source that was delivered and now is in the hands of the regional committee for review.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll point out a couple things on the report. Just the tally at the end, we're percent complete or on track, is at roughly 73% total. And then you might notice the box in the lower left, the blue box, just we're trying to keep track of high priority strategic initiatives that get added mid-year, and the assignment to work on a fiber finalization plan that we're planning on updating you on this fall is there. So a couple of common themes, competing priorities. We have a lot going on, and some of the supply chain things become more and more challenging in all parts of our business. We're really seeing that, not just on the materials side of things, but also on the labor side of things, and doing our best to manage that. In some cases, we're actually reassigning some of our staff to take on more where we can, and in other cases, we're just looking at other options in terms of whether we can get materials another way, or potentially even reprioritize projects or defer them. So
does it increase the budget in these departments to go out for more inventory, those kinds of things? I would think that would require more revenue to.
I wish it did, because that means we would get the materials here.
No, but I mean,
but to
moving
your point,
forward though, looking in,
yeah,
looking in
to your point, in some cases we may need to increase volumes, which would increase budgets, and we would definitely come back to the board if that's done outside of a budget cycle.
Yeah, I imagine the pressure on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's part of the challenge. You know, trying to get out ahead, if everybody's doing that, it just makes the problem even worse.
Right.
So it's one of those things that's we're trying to stay in the loop with what our peers are doing and trying to figure out the best way to attack the problem. So,
okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I hope this goes without saying, but it's not unnoticed everything that is accomplished. And so sometimes the negative reporting, there's just concern. I know everybody's working very hard. Of course, this keeps us accountable for actions, but I appreciate everything that you all are achieving. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other?
I'd just like to piggyback on Kelly's comments, and that is that it is easy, as we have a review of projects that are maybe running a little behind schedule. It's easy to not recognize the projects that actually get done on time. And I'm very impressed by the percentage completed on schedule for the second quarter alone was 4.75%. First quarter was a little over 4.5. So we're actually getting jobs completed. We're having success with our completed on task, 73%. So I think it's very impressive. Here we are midway through the year that have these kind of numbers. They look really good. So in spite of the fact that we have a supply chain and human resource issue with not enough workers and not enough material either. So good job. Somebody's out there working really, really hard trying to find the material and get it to the job so it can be done.
Yeah.
Nice work.
Thank you. Thanks to the whole team.
I'd just like to add, too, that you know, it's the way we report nowadays is we're always reporting on the things that are behind. And really, it's a small portion of what really goes on here. But it's just our format and how we report during our quarters that makes it seem like we're falling behind on all these projects. And I also want to reiterate that, you know, that it looks good moving forward with the projects that are being completed. So I just want to throw that out there. That it's not all negative. Thank you, guys. You've been doing a good job.
Thank you. We really tried to report on the blue squares too, the ones that just to acknowledge the things that are still getting done.
And right.
You know, yeah. Appreciate the comments.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Energy efficiency.
I'd like to invite Andrew Grizzell up. It's got some exciting news for us on our energy efficiency programs and some challenges and some potential solutions. So welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, commissioners. My name's Andrew Grisell. I manage our customer energy solutions team. One of the areas of responsibility for that is our energy efficiency programs. This will be discussing one of the very needed components of that, which is funding for incentives. And so just to note that at the end of this, like you to consider a motion for a budgetary increase for our incentive programs. And so, first of all, I want to start out, why do we do our energy efficiency incentives? There's really three primary value streams that we see for our community and for our customers. We have the benefits, of course, to our participating customers where they get the benefit of the measures going in, whether it's a new HVAC, new windows. They get more comfort, they get energy savings. Sometimes it increases value of their home, so that's great. We also have benefits to our non-participating customers. Those are the customers that are not able to, for some reason, to participate in the programs. And what we and the benefit there is the energy that's saved from our efficiency programs increases the amount of energy we can take to the wholesale market, which is at a greater rate than what we would receive from customer rates. And so the energy saved slows our load growth. It provides more energy to sell in the markets. And just as a note, since we've started about 2010, we've saved almost 25 megawatts of energy through the incentive program. And that is enough to power about 12,500 homes. So you think about all that load growth going on out there. That's what we've been able to bring that down. And this, of course, is our great team that we have. Kirk mentioned teams earlier, the board, and we have a wonderful group that's working on these at all the time. And then also it benefits our local economy. A large portion of the incentives that we pay go to local contractors to do the work. And so that's something that a lot of times we don't talk to, but it's been especially important, like when we had, you know, some slower economic times in the past where we're able to get some of those dollars into local contractors' hands, keep people on board, keep people working still. And so it's a good program for that as well.
Aaron, I just, you know, 25 megawatts save, what's the rough math on that as far as the dollars that can be generated for the district?
Depending on the market price, somewhere between $20 to $25 million. So
that's substantial.
That depends on whether it's $70 a megawatt hour, or if you take those megawatts, turn them into megawatt hours, and move that all out.
Well, for most people,
and it's a high level estimate, but
I understand. But you know, for most people, say 25 megawatts. Yeah. What does that mean? You know, what does that mean to me, or what does that mean to the district? Yeah. And so, a dollar associated with that dollar value is a little clearer.
Yeah, and that's using current market prices or what we've seen in some of the.
Of course,
you know, recent sales that we've had, those sorts of things, and then The other important note is that 25 megawatts isn't just this year. These programs have a 15-year weighted average life. So we hit 25 megawatts, and then we get 25 next year, 25 the year after, or a little bit more up until that 15-year period, and then it starts to level out. And then we just keep getting those. So it's not an additive. It's not 25 plus 25, but we keep seeing that 25 average megawatts there that keeps going year after year. So it's not just a one-time thing.
The dollar value is substantial. Yeah.
Okay. And we'll get to a little bit later how we look at that with regards to our hurdle rate. We have a hurdle rate that we want to get to ensure that we always are creating value to the customers and we're not taking it away through the incentives. So sure. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute.
Okay. Thanks.
So the next side is setting the energy efficiency incentives and how we do it. We really have four components to that. On the benefit side, we have our value of our energy, our capacity, and our value of carbon. On the cost side, of course, is what are we spending internally to get that? Is it, how much should our incentives be? And then we compare the two against each other. And our hurdle rate is a benefit cost ratio of greater than one. And over to the right is just an example of some of the outputs of the model that we use. And it shows kind of where that falls into. So it goes through, there's this really large, does a bunch of math, and it kicks out the numbers. And so that's where we're looking at. Many times we work to be above a 1.5 to 1.75 because we want to make sure that we're kind of well above that benefit number. And so 1.5 to 1.75 benefit cost ratio is where we like to be. As we'll note a little bit later, there is one caveat to that, and that's our local government program. And we generally provide up to the avoided cost for those programs because that's a program that benefits our local governments. Our customers are their constituents. If they can lower their costs, they can put tax dollars to use somewhere else. They don't have to spend it on that. And so it's we'll talk a little bit about a couple programs that fall under that a little bit later. So what are the drivers of the budget request that I'll mention a little bit later? First up in the upper left-hand corner, just a snapshot of where we are this year. Compliance target is 0.84. We do have a state compliance target that we need to hit every 2 years. This is that number basically cut in half for an annual target. Our stretch goal, which we're always trying to get as long as there's value to capture, is about 2 average megawatts. And acquired to date, what we've done today, we've already beat our compliance target, and these numbers were from July, and so we're just about halfway there, and we've about halfway hit our target about halfway. So the drivers, as I mentioned earlier, we set our incentives based on what we're seeing in the market. And for the 2023 incentive budget that we had, we used a market from around August, September of last year. We were looking at the numbers. We were seeing a little bit of participation drop off from our customers because costs are getting more for everybody else. I mean, costs for all of the equipment, costs for labor for all to install the programs, they were going up. We started seeing a little bit of drop off in participation. So we went back in December, reevaluated what the market was looking like, and that caused us to want to increase our incentives. We were looking like, the market had gone up substantially. We realigned to that new market value to move forward. And of course, with that, we got greater participation in the programs. So we're about 40% greater than we were in 2022 overall. And this is a really big number because residential can be hard to attack at times. We almost doubled what we were doing in 2022. And so good news there. We also had opportunity to fund a couple large local government projects. And generally with our large projects, we, of course, try to identify them in the year prior so that the funding is there. Sometimes, though, as we're looking around, we'll find worthy projects in the middle of the, in the middle of the budget year, and we don't want to say no, and then they may not be able to get it into their plans. And so we had a City of Wenatchee wastewater treatment plant project. This is putting new blowers and motors into the agitation area. The original ones were put in the 90s. They were large, oversized, and efficient. We worked with a design firm to help figure out what the right sizes were, and with that, we are looking at improving those operations and the efficiencies of that plant. We also had a City of Cashmere wastewater treatment plant lighting program, and I do have a video of that that I thought I would share, just to see the not just the energy from our side, but you can see the safety component from the people that are working there from their side.
Cashmere recently upgraded the outdoor lighting at its wastewater treatment plant with help from Chelan County PUD. Before, poor lighting was a hazard for employees. Now, the new lighting illuminates the right spaces, and employees are safer and more productive. What's more, their new efficient lighting and controls lower their electric bills month after month. Upgrade the lighting at your business today. Chelan County PUD can cover up to 100% of the project costs for lighting and controls that save electricity.
So, great project. Improves their safety, improves their efficiency. We paid about 90% of that project, we're able to pay about 90% of that project. We'll probably pay around 70%, just under 70% of the Wenatchee wastewater treatment plant. And so all those additional funds that they're not spending, they're able to hopefully serve our customers and their constituency better.
But it just occurred to me, Andrew, that if someone, I guess I'm guilty of this, is that, you know, you do these upgrades to your own facilities and you don't require, you know, you don't ask for assistance from the PUD, we don't get credit for that then.
That's correct. As a utility, as a region, would not get credit for those savings.
Yes, as I upgraded my shop with the, you know, the LED lighting and all that, and paid for it, but I never actually asked for any assistance. So that credit just doesn't even apply here at all.
That's correct. I mean, we're happy it's there. So we actually got the energy savings.
Yeah,
for nothing. That's not the.
But we're not getting credit. You're not getting credit for it.
That's
granted, we're getting the savings, but it doesn't go into our program, and you don't get to measure it against everything. And so there's a lot of that probably going on.
I don't know of a way to put a number on that. What I do know is that we work really hard with. I've got a staff member who is does a lot of really good work on trying to get that out to our customers. That video is one of those. And so what we do is we try to hit a number of different channels, communications channels that we have to get to customers. Commercial, that was, you know, pointing towards our commercial and our local government. We have a whole bunch of other assets on the other side that we work with to try to inform our residential customers.
But what about the process? If someone wants to put a heat pump in, for instance, mm-hmm. and they're not aware of what that process is, where you have to have a, you know, licensed contractor and all those kinds of things done, are we getting that message out? Because I've talked to other customers too that just go, oh, well, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah.
And then they miss out on the savings. Yeah. And I know
we really try the best we can. And one of the really important ways with which we do that is to work with our contractors. We work really closely with our contractors to try to help them to understand, because they're always going to be the first point of contact.
And are they passing that information on, or are they just doing the job? You know,
the vast majority of them are, because that helps them sell.
Yeah.
And so when they see, oh, when a customer sees, oh, I can get a better system for maybe less, maybe the same, maybe less, depends on the incremental cost.
Right.
Get that.
You're getting some value out of it. Yeah.
But, you know, then they're, you know, that benefits the contractor. And so that's why we also try not to change our incentives and our structures very, like, throughout the year. We try to keep it to maybe once a year, because it's really hard to, you know, get all of our contractors up to speed, and then they have to get all their employees up to speed. And so we try to only do that once a year. But that's really the key. And we do have a really, I think a really strong program with that. Josh Mitchell, our residential lead on these, is always communicating and contacting our contractors, trying to inform them. Scott's our commercial lead. He does a great job with works more on the distributor, a little bit higher level, since it's more commercial industrial. And so we really do. We work hard at it. It's something we have to continuously do. It's like a continuous improvement sort of activity where you're always assessing how well you're doing and are there things we can do better. And so, you know, getting feedback from customers that say, hey, I didn't know about that, that helps us work on trying to figure out, well, why is that and what can we do better?
Well, like when they give, like a contractor gives an estimate, you know, to do a job, it'd be kind of nice to say, well, and this is the incentive that goes with it.
Many of them do that.
Okay.
And so many of them do that. Maybe not all of them yet, but that many of them do have a, I just had mine done a couple of years ago, and all of the contractors I had, I didn't mention who I worked for or what I did. They all came out with estimates and said, oh, by the way, here's the rebate amount that you, you
can. Yeah, I need to change my contract. Really helping this.
But it is. I mean,
I haven't got one time for the. Yeah, I've done all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and so yes, and the other thing we always try to communicate to customers is if you have a question, call us first. And that's sometimes hard too. But as they're putting things in, call us, let us know so we can really confirm that what you're doing meets our standards, because we do have really strict standards to ensure that what we're paying for is what we're getting. We don't want to just give our public funds out and not get a return on that. And so we do have some strict standards, and sometimes they can be confusing. And so we do try to simplify, but we also say, call us. We have a great team of customer support folks that work for us. They have usually all the answers. And so, yeah. Call us. Hopefully your contractors know. If they don't, call us again. So we have staff for that. Most people have an app for that, staff for that. So, and they're very good at their job.
So, Andrew, I realize it's completely off topic for the presentation you're making, but a question that, that Commissioner Berggren raised just hit me. A big part, not a big part, but a portion of what we spend on energy efficiency is through the Alliance. And I'm not sure that either Kelly or Karnan are aware of how that works, because, you know, I got to thinking about, you know, I was getting mad, too, that I bought the LED lights for my garage. Well, we get credit for that after a fashion.
We do in a way, and I won't go into too much detail on that now, because we are going to be looking at that in the near future. We do belong to a group called the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. They go out and they move. Their goal is to transform the energy efficiency market by making things come online faster, quicker, and more and less expensively in the marketplace, so that the hopefully those products are there for customers to buy. And that a lot of that lighting that is has been done falls under that sort of umbrella. So that was a good catch. I don't want to get it. It's technical, and we will have a conversation on that, because that's going to be something that comes up in the next couple of years as to do we continue with that membership. Right. But there is something out there where we have gotten credit for things like that, because they have moved the market and we've helped pay to help them move that market. And that's all you can buy.
So those light bulbs I buy at Costco,
yes, we
get some credit for that.
Yes, and we have in the past. Some of that stuff moves off and some moves on as far as in their portfolio. But yes, historically, we have gotten some credit for those. All right, now to the, I guess, I don't know, the drum roll. We are looking for a budget revision request for both our residential and our commercial industrial program. $1 million to finish the year for our residential, $2 million for our commercial industrial. The funding will provide about a 1.7 benefit cost ratio. So the benefits on all the energy pieces of it compared to how much we're providing for the incentive. As part of that, two local government projects are included in that. That's about $1 million of it, close to it, not quite, but almost $1 million to that. And then, of course, it helps us to continue our residential commercial programs in a manner that is, you know, starting and stopping energy efficiency programs is really hard on the program. There's a lot of the customers get confused. There's a lot of those things that happen too. And so this will just help keep that continuation going. The residential numbers, we came up with these numbers by looking what we've done so far this year, sort of forecasting that out, what we think, looking at our normal spend rates, too, of when those dollars come. And so it is a forecast. We might not spend all of it, or we might spend all of it. And so, but it's a number that hopefully is safe, that we won't have to be coming back, you know, in December. So that was the goal with that as well. Any questions so far?
Clearly, my subsidizing of the PUD hasn't helped much here. But no, I think that's I think you're correct in moving forward. You know, you do not want to stop a program. It does get confusing, and I've heard those kinds of things. Or is this program still in play, or whatever? And so I understand what your goal is here.
Thank you.
Is this request? So a third of it for residential, is that about equal to the amount of energy efficiencies that's gained? A third of it is for residential, two-thirds for commercial?
No, actually, generally, commercial industrial is about, well, I guess we thought of it that way. No, it's usually, commercial industrial usually covers about 70% of our savings. The residential is a little more expensive. Our benefit cost ratio is generally a little bit less. So when we look at that 1.7, residential might be 1.3, 1.5. Commercial industrial might be something heavy, bigger. And that's just because of the extra amount that it just takes to get, you know, a resident to do something they're thinking about. Boy, can I budget this now versus a company that may look a couple years, you know, may look, have a little bit longer viewpoint. And so generally they're more expensive, and generally they don't save quite as much energy as you're looking at that as a percentage of the whole. But overall, I know our customers, we get great feedback from our customers on most of our programs. So, and that comes back to that that number for the residential side is such a large component because of that. You know, we've almost doubled the participation rate from the year prior, and so we have a lot more of our customers participating. And I don't know if that's because people aren't buying as many houses now, and maybe they're, you know, putting their money into the house they have, or, you know, what the market driver is for that as well.
Andrew, I had a question on residential. What is the top thing that individuals do to their personal residence that you're seeing reflected in the conservation plan?
What we're seeing right now is HVAC. Our whether it's a ductless heat pump, which are those units that are on the wall. You know, you have them on the wall and down. You can put multiple different units in your house on those, or the standard heat pump retrofit. Right now, that's probably our biggest in the residential side. That's driving a lot of that budget revision as well. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Any member of the audience have any input? So do we have a proposed motion before us?
All right. I will move to increase the 2023 total budget for regulatory asset project 00109080. Did I just pick the longest motion? Residential energy programs in the amount of $1 million for a revised total 2023 regulatory asset budget amount of $2,250,000, and to increase the 2023 total budget for regulatory asset project 00109085, commercial energy programs in the amount of $2 million for a revised total 2023 regulatory asset budget amount of $4 million, and to increase the total 2023 distribution system regulatory asset budget by $3 million for a revised total amount of $7,670,000. Woohoo!
We have to be specific where the dollars are going.
I am so grateful that I didn't look at that ahead.
Is there a second to that motion?
I'll second.
And by the way, Kelly, you've got that job permanently.
That's a great job. Good job.
Thank you.
Is there any discussion on the motion? This is completely out of line for the chair to do this, but this is a philosophical thought on what we're doing. This is maybe the single most visible big win-win for our utility with our customers that we do on an ongoing basis. This makes us visible to our customers, and it endears the relationship of we're trying to help people of Chelan County. And for that, I say, as a commissioner, thank you for bringing this to us, because we need to, when it's cost effective, we need to go for it in Chelan County.
Thank you for that.
And I might add, on my way in today, I was listening to Public Power Underground. Does anybody listen to that?
No.
It's an awesome podcast by a public utility out of Oregon. But one of the interesting things that they were talking about were auctions similar to what airlines do. So trying to incentivize consumers to perhaps auction off their power during the day. So maybe they're not at home. They'll auction off some of it, and then it goes to the highest bidder. So, you know, there's a lot of creative thought process on how to capture some extra power right now. And this just seems like a very simple, and back to your point, obvious way of helping our residents and our users locally without having to figure out some of these other creative processes. But listen to that, Public Power Underground. Highly recommend it.
Wow. It sounds sort of hidden.
Underground.
Sure.
I'd like to just chime in here, only because I want to comment on the value of this conservation plan. Personally, I've taken advantage of a home inspection from one of your team members to come out and determine where all the cold air is coming in at in the middle of winter. And it's a great program. And when we talk about public power benefit back to the community, and that's what we're all about, and it says that on the side of our building, is that, you know, owned by the people we serve, and we're trying to help and give back to the people of the county of Chelan. And this is one of the best programs among many, but one of the best programs, and probably, as Randy said, most visible program that residents can take advantage of to help cut their energy bill. You know, and a lot of times, I know in my former career, we would talk with people about just the amount of paycheck left at the end of the month is just shrinking. And here is one free opportunity for residents of the county to have an evaluation, home audit done, and maybe reduce your cost of electricity, putting more money in the end of the month for you. So it's just one way that Chelan County continues to reach out, and that your team is helping to make that possible. And it is very painless. I can attest to that firsthand, having had one of your team members come out and do an audit of my house. So I would encourage anyone listening to this recording or anyone reading the excerpts of this today, this is a really important project for all of the members of the county to take advantage of and reduce their cost. And you guys do a great job. So thank you very much.
Thanks. And I know our team has really been thankful for the support we've gotten. We've always had really good support from our commission and from our managers, and they really appreciate it. So
I'm just going to weigh in here and say that I think it's a very, very good program, and that as a utility, we're limited, I guess, on our resources, what comes down the river. And I know from past experiences, we've always talked about it, but conservation is a resource for the utility, and it brings value back not only for the residents, like Commissioner Arsenal said, it brings tremendous value back to the utility, because that's generation that we can sell or use in other ways. And so the value is really huge. It's much greater than what this additional request is. So I'm much in favor of this program and the value that it actually brings back. It's a win-win-win for everybody on this deal. So that's how I feel about the program. So, good job.
Okay. Any other discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is carried.
Thank you very much. You appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate yours.
Thanks, Andrew. Keep up the good work.
Item 7, local utility district in lieu of connection charge.
Yeah, as Ron Slabaugh is joining us for this one. This is part of our efforts to review our customer policies, and similar to the latecomers fees that we talked about in latecomers program, we're looking at this one too, looking for ways to adjust our policies for better customer service and streamline processes for staff too. So, Ron, thanks for presenting this one.
Okay. Thank you, Kirk. And before I pivot to this topic, just following Andrew, I just would like to share with you that as a resident of Chelan County, I did take advantage of the residential HVAC program that we have here to have the heating and air conditioning system replaced in my home. And particularly Andrew's team member, Josh, I went to him for some advice and instruction. And he shared with me the list of the qualified contractors that work within our program, but also some challenges that I might see in my 1978 home. And he was spot on with all of it. And the whole program itself was seamless, updated the system. I honestly installed a system with more capability that provided more comfort to my home and also more energy efficiency than I otherwise would have. Both as a resident, a full supporter of the program. It was great. So now on to this. Thanks for the introduction, Kirk. Connection charge in lieu of assessments related to local utility districts here at Chelan PUD. So why are we here? I want to review these LUDs and these connection charge in lieu of assessments, discuss some of the challenges that we have with them, and ultimately recommend some policy changes for all LUDs. Informational only, I'm not asking for any action today. A lot of information on this one slide. Local utility districts follow RCW 54 and board approved policy. In general, they're a funding mechanism where we install a utility improvement. That utility improvement increases the value of the properties that benefit from it. There is within a defined service area boundary. The cost of that benefit is paid by those properties, and it can be paid, as indicated here, over the term of the LUD, although it's not necessarily required. We did dig up some data from some of our past LUDs. 5 to 10% of property owners will just pay right up front, and they don't take the loan. And at the 10-year mark, about 60% of properties have typically paid off. And a lot of times that has to do with real estate transactions, either a purchase or a refinance, because, and Eric will help me if I don't get this right, the banks won't subordinate the LUD lien. So it's usually just rolled into the refinance or the purpose.
Yep. That's a bank choice, though. That's a policy choice. The law doesn't require one way or the other.
So within district policy for our LUDs, we established this connection charge in lieu of assessment. And it's a matter of equity. What we're trying to establish there is that, let me just paint an example where folks within the boundary pay an amount for this benefit. And the next year, somebody across the street who wasn't within the boundary connects to it and doesn't pay a similar charge. We wanted to avoid that. So going back decades when the first of our LUDs was established, we included language such that property outside the area would need to pay something similar to if they had been included in the LUD to begin with. Here's just some of the current PUD LUDs. We have Sleepy Hollow, which was extending a water service into the Sleepy Hollow area back in the late 1990s. That was a repayment term of 30 years. Actually, all properties have paid off, but the LUD term itself continues through 2028. Monitor, which I think folks here would be most familiar with, that was our last one, extended water service out to Monitor. It's a 20-year term. It'll retire in 2029. There's still 84 properties that are paying on Monitor. Alala Canyon, another water term of 20 years. That one, see, paid off in 2017. There's no properties that are still paying on that. Peshaston Wastewater, 30-year term, retire in 2028, and there's still 11 properties repaying on that one. Lake Wenatchee was 20 years. It's all paid off. Last property paid in about 2014. Some of the challenges that we have with these. Sleepy Hollow is the only one where we have an actual charge in lieu calculation methodology that established a charge for properties outside. And we'll show you some examples of that a little bit later. We never did, within that language, sunset or expire the timelines. So in the case of the LUDs on the previous page that are all, you know, complete, if a property came to us today and wanted that's outside of that original area and wanted to hook up to it, we'd be scrambling to figure out what an appropriate charge in lieu would be. A lot of times we have folks that were involved with these. Lake Wenatchee, it started back in 1991. Folks are gone. So we lose the institutional knowledge and those that are really familiar with these LUDs, what was covered, what the processes are.
But when you're talking about the LUD, you're talking about the LUD that's inside a service area? Or are you talking about connections that come outside the service area and then one?
Well, we're talking about both. The Pacific here, the connection charge in lieu of assessment is for properties that are outside of the original service boundary.
The original, LUD. But still within the service area of the district?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. And we'll see in a later example, some of these can be a cost barrier for new connections. And, of course, we would rather encourage new connections to our system to help with financial sustainability. And this is the example for Sleepy Hollow where we have that established. In 97, when Sleepy Hollow came online, the cost for a new water service all in, including the water meter box, the water meter, and the system development charge, was $3,242 on the main system and would have been $11,064 in Sleepy Hollow. And fast forward to today, our cost all in for a service on our main system is $11,882 on average. And that would be, again, for the water meter box, system development charge, the meter installation fee. But in Sleepy Hollow, it's up over $32,000. And that it is a barrier for connections within that Sleepy Hollow area.
No doubt.
So what are we looking to achieve? Some of this language you'll be familiar with, no doubt, with our rate and policy setting. We want to develop practices that are fair, equitable, non-discriminatory, easy to explain, understand, and administer. We do indeed want to encourage new utility connections for folks that desire to connect to our system and enhance that overall customer experience. Have a few options here. One, this is our current method. And as I mentioned with Sleepy Hollow, it's an increasing balance. So each year that goes by, folks would pay a little bit more to connect to the system. And with Sleepy Hollow, within the final assessment roll, 1997 in Zone 1, $7,613 to connect. You can see that increase to, 2023, current year, $20,479. The different zones that you see here, Zone 1, 2, and 3, or just think of it as sub-boundaries within the overall LUD that benefited from different portions of the original improvement, so there was different assessment amounts established for those different zones. And again, no sunset date. So even when Sleepy Hollow is all done, and I believe it was 2028, we would technically still, if somebody came to us in 2030 or 2032, under current policy, they would still have to apply a charge in lieu of assessment.
Ron, along with those charges that, we know what the cost is and what you're predicting moving forward on each one of these systems, but do we know what the capacity is for each one of these systems and how much, we can actually put on the existing infrastructure without increasing demand, capacity?
Sure. Yeah, it is something that we actively track for our systems.
But do you know it?
Do we know it for each?
For each one of our utilities, water, wastewater?
Right now, today, for every single one, no. We have the capability, of course. On the main water system, we do, provided that we don't have a very large request.
But is that something that you plan to do in the future, is have that information as well?
For
each one, capacity.
Sure.
Like if you go to a wastewater system, how many hookups can you have on the existing system?
Yeah, and based on organic growth, we have that. The challenge does come in when we
but
have
our organic growth. But our organic growth is not necessarily a correct figure to use.
Well, it's what we've historically
used. It's historical information,
and it's challenging. if not impossible, to predict that non-organic growth. We have to wait for an applicant to come in with their project. And, you know, as I mentioned, you know, Mission Ridge is one, and Kaler Glen wastewater was another one where they would have chewed up a substantial amount of capacity.
Yeah, but my my point is, do we know what that capacity is? So if somebody comes in and says, hey, you know, I want to do a development, or we tell them exactly what we can put on the system. I think that would be a beneficial number. We've got the cost of each one of these, but do we really know what the capacity is of it? We should be able to have that.
Yeah, where we don't, we can. And in the case of, again, using Mission Ridge and Kaler Glen as an examples, we got an application from those developers, and they paid us a fee to go in and study that and figure out what not only the existing capacity, but also what it would take in general to serve their large development. You know, the few homes, and you know, what we're here talking about today is these residential, like, you know, single charge in lieu of assessment. That's pretty easy for us. Larger developments are a little bit more challenging. But as I mentioned, it's usually an application from the developer because they're seeking information, and we get more information from them to which we can go out and study. Where there's a cost associated with that, and those two that I cited, there was. They paid for that cost. And then we or our consultant completed the study, and we communicated that to them. So
but
we
if,
didn't have
but if I was to ask you today if what the monitor water system could handle as far as, you know, customer hookups, you couldn't tell me.
Not today.
No. Yeah.
But I can tell you that within our regular demand forecasting, what we typically expect to see with developments out there, that there is adequate capacity, certainly, for when we completed the last study.
I understand that, but the capacity issue is not a figure that we have currently.
No, and it changes over time as we accept new connections to the system.
Right. Okay. Right.
And I just want to be clear that, you know, what Ron's describing is our current policies and practices. That's how we operate. And so if the board would like to change those, we certainly
just teeing it up for conversation.
Yeah. Okay. No, I just want to explain, make sure that it's clear that what Ron's doing is right in line with current policies.
Got it.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
You're not in the hot spot there.
No, you're not.
Didn't feel it.
It's just something that, you know, it always seems to come up, you know, with every discussion, every development, whatever. It's like, what is our capacity? And it's been one of those things, because of policy or whatever, we've not been able to have that quick answer. So it always takes more time for these things to get, you know, now you need to bring somebody in, you got to do the study. I'm aware of all those things, but all of those things take time. And adds on pancakes, all the things that you have to do in order to move forward with a home or any of this stuff. It's just more and more. And so to me, it just seemed like that would be a natural thing for our utility to have as an answer for whether it's fiber, water, whatever it is that we're doing, that we know what that our capacity level is. But that's all. So, and we can talk about it someday.
Okay. Well, thank you, Carmen. The other alternative, and this is the one that we are recommending, utilizes instead of increasing approach, a declining balance approach. And it's just recognizing that folks are buying into a depreciated or used asset. It's not new anymore. We utilize this method that I have to shout out to Kelly Boyd for recommending to us, that, again, recognizing that it's the declining value of that asset. But using that Sleepy Hollow example, instead of that charge in lieu of assessment in 2023 being $20,479, it would be $1,269. We saw in an earlier slide the cost today, the rough cost of a water service, the box, the system development charge, the meter being, I think it was $11,880. This would add $1,269 to that, which we feel is still affordable relative to the current method, which would increase the cost of that water service to over $32,000. In summary, current method, again, increasing balance and it does not sunset. What we're recommending is a declining balance with that sunsets at the end of that loan term. Most of those have been 20-year loan terms. And then it would go away, and folks that would connect to that part of the system would pay the same as any other customer. Our next steps, of course, is to gather feedback. I'd like to hear your thoughts from today and ultimately return to you with a resolution for your consideration to establish that standardized charge in lieu of assessment calculation methodology and establish sunset dates. That's for all of our LUDs.
Can we go back to the declining balance? I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. So using the depreciation as the structure, then that is the remaining life, the value of that, the life of that asset, right? Is that what's being taken into consideration? And so when we get down to such a minimal amount, who incurs the cost then of the replacement of the infrastructure?
So good question. And we utilize the term of the LUD, the original, say, financing term. The value of the asset may be greater than that. But back to our guiding principles of something that's fair, equitable, non-discriminatory, and easy to explain and understand, aligning this declining balance with the loan term seemed like something to us that was, quite frankly, easy to apply to all of the LUDs and to explain to the customer. And then once that payment is over, it just sunsets. In many cases, like with water distribution, I think we depreciate our water lines over a 40 or a 50-year life right now. So there is still value in the system and useful life in the system. And the way that we're currently handling it, the way that we currently handle, we've handled our replacements is with rates and cash that we have in the system over the last several years.
So would you say, before Kelly dives in, I'm just, question is really important. But MAPE is a direct answer to, you have to incur capital expenses on one of or many of our subsystems going forward. Is that cost get spread across all of our water customers throughout the county then? It becomes, we go to the postage stamp rate. So the answer to yours is, if a subsystem, you know, has, demands attention, all the users pay for it at the end of the LUD. Does that make it simpler?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just wanted to help Ron on the of supporting him on his description and to kind of the philosophy that you were thinking through there. It really is the matching of your buying into a system that has a shorter useful life now than at the beginning. So you're kind of matching, stepping into that asset in its current state and paying for the remainder that you would use over the rest of the useful life. LUD debt is generally tied to the average useful life of all of the assets that are financed through that. And then the concept would be, and then as you continue on as a user, both a component of your rate goes to pay as you go for cash for, you know, keeping up with future asset replacements, and then any debt that would need to be issued perhaps to pay for long-lived assets would become a component of a rate also for the future. So that's how it's paid for on an ongoing basis with all the existing customers.
Okay, after saying that, you know, because we're figuring current connections, life of the, you know, of the infrastructure, do we even consider the future connections on this and the revenue that would be generated over time as growth occurs? That's why a capacity issue, in my view, would be very important to know exactly what the system could handle, and then you have a number that you can use as a future revenue source, I guess, is that considered at all, or is it just the current users and that's it?
So for this charge?
Yeah.
It's bringing a new customer that's coming into an asset it's bringing them on an even playing field for equity of the people that finance that.
Right, but are we looking at the potential?
So for this charge, it's about the connection to the existing system for these individual users. But on the big picture of the system as a whole, yes, we use a forecasting rate of growth that we're looking at for the system as a whole as it relates to a cost of service analysis and a long-term self-sustainability.
So we must have a number out there that's, what capacity and what that number. To use that number, you're going to have to know what it actually can service if it was built out to 100%.
And so our capital programs look at those growth rates and have long-term capital programs, and those all go into it. So I would say it's not a one-for-one relationship of you have to have that capacity number at that individual level in order to do the big picture forecast.
But you're using a number there to do that forecasting.
A growth number, yes.
Okay. Well, all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Yep. Any other questions or comments from the board?
Just a comment for Kelly that only an accountant would use a declining balance approach. That's complicated. I had to do that. I'm sorry.
Oh, I completely understand. And in support of that approach, what we set out to achieve here, we feel it was very appropriate.
Commissioners, comments, feedback, and any member of the public. There's no member, I don't believe. We believe we have a member of the media here, but so they're looking for feedback.
Ron, if I can just jump in for 1 second and suggest that with respect to Karnan's question, that there is a capacity number that when the system was built, the engineers who designed the system built it to a capacity. So there is a capacity number.
Right.
And Ron, I bet you could probably have that to Commissioner Bergman here in short order if you look back at the original engineering drawings, and it would spell out capacity. So there is something. So I think
I'm aware of it, but we don't. I agree with Kurt. Our policy needs to maybe be looked at again and how we look at fulfilling our obligation and serving on these different utilities that we have, because it's a critical number. And when we look at growth in the valley and our county, that we should have right at our fingertips what our systems are capable of doing. And we put that all on contractors and different people to say, well, we want to do this. And if it's over one house, I don't know what the number is that triggers this. But one house, we don't need to do it because we know we can service it. But we're not sure exactly what our service capabilities are for other systems. And I think we can do that with fiber, water, wastewater, even electricity in some cases. So I think a good conversation on how we look at being able to provide that information would help facilitate, some of the growth in our county and low, because time is money. Everything raises the cost, and every delay that we do in anything raises the cost, especially when you're in an inflationary period like we are today. So I think it's really important that we have those numbers at our fingertips and say, we can answer these questions when they come to us and be prepared to serve. That's our obligation, is to serve and give people the information that they need to do without, it just seems like it's something that just we should know and communicate that when asked. So, anyway, we need to have a policy discussion. We must have one.
Yeah, I think the policy discussion is broader than even the the piece about answering the question of capacity, it's one in which, you know, how much capacity do we want to have available for people? And we have a just-in-time construction approach for the most part, and we build our systems up to the capacity where then it takes time to add capacity, and there's triggers in doing that. And that's why I think it's broader than just having the answer. It's, well, what kind of capacity do we want to have available, mm-hmm. and how's the cost going to get allocated accordingly? And I think it is a broader conversation, one well beyond this charge in lieu of assessment, but one thing that's probably...
Well, if you bring up the topic, and I agree with you, Kurt, that it's a broad issue that really needs it. We really need to sit down as a staff and as a commission and talk about our future and how we move forward with these things. So I agree with you. I'm just looking forward to the opportunity to do it.
Yep.
And I do have a couple more questions. I'm wondering if there are currently new developments or something that has happened that has made this a priority right now.
There aren't any new developments in Sleepy Hollow. No.
So, Commissioner, it looks like a priority right now. We've been working on it for over a year.
Okay. That's
so
fair.
It's just finally to a point that we're ready to bring it forward. So I agree with the team. It's we have different resolutions for every LUD, and cleaning them up and making them consistent would be, I would say, very valuable for customers and staff. So I don't want to give the sense that it's in the last couple of weeks.
No, I'm just trying to give you where I'm coming from is if there were something in need right now where, okay, this is thwarting development or something, but my concern is giving direction and then thinking that we might be having this larger conversation, you know, where we go one way with policy and then have a larger conversation that pivots it.
So I have two responses to that. First, there's always something with respect to LUDs that's driving it. We have customers looking to connect. I know that they're dealing, that's probably Sarah got up, they're dealing with some in the Sleepy Hollow right now, which is why Sleepy Hollow is the example. That is something that, though, is... I'm going to say ongoing periodically through the years because we don't control, and I think that was part of the point, or we don't control when people decide to connect or, you know, develop. So,
and then how do you remedy?
The second response I have, though, is I don't know. I have to think about it. There's not a resolution today, but we can think about it between now and then. Is I don't know that conversation, which I agree is important to have, really impacts this. Because this is a already established system with, in many cases, already repaid borrowing. And in each of those resolutions previously, it sets out that staff will calculate or the district will calculate a charge in lieu of assessment for those latecomers, the folks that want to connect to a system outside of the boundary. We don't always do that. You've heard that from Ron. In fact, I would argue in some cases we can't do that presently the same way we started because Growth Management Act and other changes to how properties are developed have impacted that over the 20 plus years since we've had them. So what we're really talking about is a consistent approach to how we would allow people who were not originally within the side or the lines of an LUD, which is a kind of a unique monster that I'm happy to spend however many afternoons you want talking about it. Those folks need to buy into the system pursuant to resolution. We're really just talking about how do they buy into the system. Those things assume capacity. So, as part of the connection fee that they're going to pay, all of the other work in terms of how, when, how much are we able to connect are not addressed by this. This is merely what is the check that you write depending upon when you connect. I don't think that any change to those policies, which really relate to that future planning and growth, will change this piece. At least I can't think of how, but I will spend some time chewing on that. So I don't know if that helps you in response. But
your answers always
help. Thank you. I doubt that, but thank you.
Yes. I was just going to tag on to what Erica said. Sarah Delosier, Customer Service. We do have people often wanting to connect. Monitor is a great example. Sleepy Hollow, we have rates for in lieu of connection. We do not have for Monitor. So presently those customers are hopefully positively waiting in the background while we work to figure out what the methodology will be so we can actually provide connections and costs to those customers.
So that's a really good thought, sir. I apologize for not remembering that. But this is the replacement for all of that work, some of which we wouldn't be able to. So the best example I have, for example, is Lake Wenatchee, where initially it was established on a per square foot allocation of your original LUD share if you were inside the boundaries. There were some reasons that was done relative to lot size and how many you could cut up and build new houses. So that's one, for example, that since that time, growth management has come in and you can no longer, some of the assumptions that were used in that original assessment, you could take a 5-acre parcel and chop it up into a bunch of quarter acres, right? We thought that person, or I wasn't here, the board thought that person who had that future development capability shouldn't pay necessarily the same as the person who had one lot that's a quarter acre and one connection, because effectively that person pays hypothetically $10,000 for one connection, the other person pays hypothetically $10,000 for, you know, 5 times 4, 20 connections. So growth management came in after that, and you can't subdivide or develop your properties that way anymore. So that's an example of an assumption that was made in the first instance that for a number of reasons wouldn't work today. And we actually addressed that issue back in the 2005-06 timeframe, as I recall. Similar scenario is always growing connection costs, trouble getting people to connect to the system, which challenges the financial resiliency of those independent systems. And we corrected that one. Frankly, we probably should have corrected them all. So this is just a way to hopefully address that in one fell swoop. Otherwise, we've got to set about going out and figuring out how to develop latecomer charges based upon something that we did in the first instance. Hope that helps.
Thank you. Yes.
Well, I personally have a lot more questions to ask about this, and maybe we could, you know, Ron or something, you can come by later and with a lot more detail of how this is, and I can contribute that way. Right now it's kind of a general thing, but I'd like to explore some different scenarios with you. That's okay.
Okay. For solving the Sleepy Hollow issue?
Okay. Sure. Because, one of the things that just comes to mind is, you know, LUDs were first established by parcel. Each parcel was brought into it. And so, if you had a 5-acre parcel, if you had 2-acre parcel, whatever, it was the same because that was a parcel. And you touched on a little bit, you can break it down into smaller units. Does that lower the cost or raise the cost, or is it the cost the same even though you break it down? I mean, some area, growth management has inhibited some areas from doing that. Other areas have the ability to break it down into smaller units. Does that raise the cost, or it's the same cost for that parcel originally was in the LUD, or is there some sort of cost savings by including more? Are you getting what I'm? That's why I kind of want to explore that, because seems to me if someone wants to break their property down into smaller units, there should be some sort of incentive to do that because it's advantageous for the utility.
So this would not affect that?
It doesn't, even though it's a one cost.
No, so if you're inside the LUD boundary, you've already paid.
You already paid.
It doesn't matter what you do with your property now, because the charge that you had was based upon a special benefit calculation at the time that we established the LUD. So that doesn't change. If you're in the boundary, you're in the boundary.
Okay, if you're outside the boundary, then...
then it's a matter of what are you paying.
And it would be the same no matter what...
Well, it would be the same based upon what you want to bring into the property, right? If you have one lot to bring in, you're going to pay this per connection.
Same price.
But if you subdivide and you connect 10, you're still paying this for each lot of the 10.
Each lot.
For each connection.
So it doesn't... you're not going to advantage or disadvantage...
because each connection pay is not property. And it's also, just for clarity, it's not the LUD rules require us to apportion and designate, I'm going to say, how much each property owner will pay based upon a special benefit analysis that is conducted as part of the LUD formation. We don't actually do that. We hire a professional appraiser to do that, and that is the information that the board uses when it, I'll say, gavels down on the creation of an LUD, what's included and what those special benefits are going to be. And then we actually have to file that with the county, and that gives rise to liens and such. But again, back to the, because it's by connection, not by property, I don't think that changes anything. Or
but the LUD was established by property, though.
So only in the sense that we drew a circle around what would be included.
Right.
Right. So, but no, the so we record liens against property, and when you're using the term property, I'm assuming you're using it in, and you mean parcel.
Yeah, parcel.
So, that's what I mean. Yeah, we file our lien by parcel, and you're responsible for whatever your allocated share is mm-hmm. for that parcel at the time because you're in the boundary.
Right.
That's set. That won't change. Period.
Okay.
I would say most of them have paid that off. Some may or may not.
So when you're talking about LUD and the zone that was originally established, so somebody that comes in from outside, does that mean we're expanding the zone?
No. The original LUD.
So they're
just
outside.
So the original LUD is just a funding mechanism.
Right.
So it's I'd say for all intents and purposes, once everybody has once the financing mechanism in terms of did we loan it, you know, however that's resolved, there is all for all intents and purposes, other than this, no longer an LUD boundary.
No, it's not. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Follow me?
Yeah.
So because it's just a financing mechanism, that's one of the reasons I think that Kelly and the team were tying it to the payoff of that indebtedness and the life of the asset. I don't see how it would advantage or disadvantage either anyone inside the LUD.
Yeah, so once the LUD is kind of paid off, then it's just kind of non-existent.
The only way that it still has any import is, as Ron suggested, because we don't have sunset dates on these charges in lieu of assessment for latecomers, people wanting to join later,
mm-hmm.
that we continue to monitor, understand, and apply the original LUD boundary really for the purpose of deciding were you in or out, do you have to pay this late connection or
right.
not.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue if we change that and go to this, then I think that's one of the benefits for the customers and for staff is it adds clarity after this has expired in terms of the repayment schedule, then we don't have to track those LUD boundaries anymore. Folks that want to join the system,
yeah,
just pay your connection charge.
Yeah, just sort of. Just
correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Happy to spend time with any or all of you, particularly those of you who've not experienced the joys of creating an LUD, offline. So just ask.
I just wanted to say thank you very much for answering my questions. It feels like the recommendation here using the declining balance does meet the objectives that you are trying to achieve. And so if you're looking feedback from this commissioner moving forward, then I would support what you have proposed.
Thank you.
Yes. In spite of my harassment of Kelly on the declining balance.
Totally understand.
And we are more than happy to spend any time with any of you going through this. So.
Okay. At this time, it looks like we're at 5 to 12. Any additional public comment at this moment? Looks like we're at a logical breaking point to take a recess and come back at 1 o'clock, unless Kirk...
You know, if you wouldn't mind, we've got staff in the room for one manager item.
Okay.
It would be really helpful. Thank you, Ron. Ron volunteered to present that last one. So
I want to acknowledge him.
There's a lot of work.
Now he's wishing the lawyer would have taken more time to write the proposal.
Kyle and Ron's
like lunch. Thanks,
Ron. Joining us. All right.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep. All right. Thank you. Well, still good morning, everyone. I'm Kyle. I'm the park superintendent for the North End Parks for the PUD, including the Chelan area. And I'm here today to talk to you about our Whitewater River boating event on the Chelan River. This event happens
the third weekend in September every year. And this year it happens to be September 16th and 17th. And how did we get here? Well, we were approached back in the 90s, early 2000s by American Whitewater wanting to look at us allowing them to boat on the Chelan River. So this led to a several year feasibility study where we looked at, is it even possible to raft or to kayak down the river? And at what flows would we need to do that to make it the best experience for them and the safest as well? Like I said, that I think was a 3-year study, which led to a license order for us to allow whitewater boating. Originally, this was to take place, I think when I was reading through the document, up to 24 boating events a year. In working with American Whitewater, we've kind of whittled that down to one weekend, which I think benefits everyone. It allows them consistency and it allows us to, quite frankly, just have one weekend where we're doing this.
White knuckled.
Yes. this is quite unusual for whitewater boating releases in the PUD world. This is an experts only release. This is class 5+. Was originally maybe class 6, but I guess once you kind of explore and run the area, it then reverts to class 5+. So my understanding is there's maybe only couple hundred people in the United States that are skilled enough to run this river when we flow. So
it's once you run it and then survive.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
That number goes down every year. Why would you run it a second time?
That second part. If you don't survive, the number doesn't change.
We have not. We have not even had any major injuries. Which is, when you look at it and when you're watching, it's amazing, really. But these are really skilled people. These are the type of boaters that would, like the boater that went down Palouse Falls. This is the type of boater that we're dealing with here. Mm-hmm. So we have two scheduled flows. So they decided in the feasibility study, the best two flows were 375 CFM. That is our Saturday flow rate. And then a 400 CFM flow rate for Sunday. We typically get somewhere between 15 and 40 people on Saturday and at most half that on Sunday. It's just a little bit more challenging, and a lot of people don't feel comfortable with the Sunday flow rate. What else? We do require registration to do this event. Not anybody can just show up and run the river. It is, you know, very challenging for people. So we work with American Whitewater to determine who has the skills necessary to do this run. I don't know. It all looks impossible to me. They do know, and we work with them. We have pre-registration. We check them in the morning of the event, and then we make sure that everybody's off the water in the afternoon. So typically, we'll start ramping up flows at 10 a.m. They're usually on the water somewhere between 10:30 and 11, wrap up their first run somewhere between 1 or 2, and then on Saturday, typically, a couple groups, maybe 5 to 10 people, will choose to do a second run, and then they have to wrap up by, you know, 5 or 6 in the evening, and then we ramp the flows back down. Sunday, rarely do we get people doing a second run. I haven't seen it since I've been here, but it's possible that they might want to do that. But, and we also, you know, at the end of it, we run a survey to find out, hey, how did you like it? Was it challenging enough? Was it too challenging? Typically, they'll also mention as they get out, that was, you know, this is our first time. That was pretty scary. I don't think I'm going to go the next day. Or, you know, hey, can you ramp it up to 500? Like, no, we're not going to do that. So for a little context, here's a really not a great map, but the put-in spot is just downstream of the Chelan Dam on the north side of the river, kind of adjacent to where the Chelan ball fields are. And then takeout is at Powerhouse Park. There's really only a section of about maybe 3/4 mile that's challenging. The rest is just kind of a float down the river. With that, are there any questions, comments?
No. Great presentation.
Thank you.
I can watch.
That's a great
picture. You can watch. You can watch from kind of the lookout above daybreak on the the Chelan, the dirt road that goes between Chelan and Chelan Falls. And that's a good place to kind of watch from there.
That picture tells a story because there's all these spotters with life jackets on.
Yes. They do. This one, I think this is double slide right here. There are some that are pretty, that most of the boaters that go down, they have to throw and they have to either self-rescue or they have to be rescued. I've watched a couple of them, and it's pretty hairy.
I just have to, you know, I had a chance to watch that years ago, and it was like six or seven were coming down, and I think it was the Sunday, and it's not one of these things that they just get in the kayaks and they just keep going all the way down. They take a fall, and then they get out, they look, they reassess where they need to go down. These are professionals that really are trying to, you know, figure out how they're going to get through those. Some of those pools are pretty dangerous. It's hard for them to get out of it. And so they do assess it before they even go down. So it's kind of a step system for these guys.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. And that's because it is dangerous, and they're pros. They know what they're looking to see how they're going to negotiate. So it's not just watching them go down one fall after another. It's a step system. And so just wanted to point that out. Yep. Thank you.
It's whether it's a good idea or not for somebody to go down this is up for debate, but I will say that it's a pretty neat opportunity, especially you think about a year like this year where you're not going to find too many streams in the area that are running like that in September, and so it's just it's a unique opportunity. We provide some of the best kayakers around to do something like this.
That's cool. It's cool. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks, Kyle.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Wow.
Well, I think it's time to recess for lunch, and we'll reconvene at 1 o'clock with our public hearing. Good afternoon. I'd like to call the August 7th, 2023 afternoon session of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission into order. We met this morning in our study session. And this afternoon is a business session, and we start right out of the chute in the business session with a public hearing on rate class 36 in Lindsay Mowens.
All right. Good afternoon, commissioners and public. As Randy mentioned, we're here to talk about rate 36, rate hearing. This is part of a normal process we have as we look to adjust rates. We always give our customers an opportunity to come listen and make comment on the process that we're going through. Let's see. So, kicking off, this process really kicked off last year with a request of the board and management and customers that we take a look at rate 35 and 36. Those rates had been in place for several years up until this point. And we really wanted to take a look at the methodology of the rates, how they were calculated, how the classes were defined, to make sure that what we are seeing now is what we expected to see, because as you recall, when we put these rates in place, everything was very new. So staff spent, I'm just one of a large group of staff that spent a significant amount of time this year looking at these rates for what we would expect to see. So welcome. We've got some customers in the room today. So today's presentation will be much like the commission heard 2 weeks ago, but for the benefit of customers, we'll go through it again so that we can cover all the bases. At the end of the last presentation, we talked about the outreach plan, so I just wanted to touch on that once more today. So as I mentioned last time, we went through a preview of the rates, and then for the last couple weeks, we've had public notice out to the public, inviting them to today's hearing to hear about the rates and provide comment on the record. And then pending the outcome of today's discussion, as well as the period between now and the next board meeting, would determine what happens next. Currently, it, on a normal rate schedule, would come to a resolution at the next board meeting. But we do have some room in our schedule to take additional time if we need to take another look at anything within these rates. So to kick off, as I mentioned, a multidisciplinary group of staff looked through and met, discussed, and understood the rates, and came up with a proposal that has really three parts. And I'll go into more depth of each of these three parts as we go. But the first is to revise the Rate 35 and Rate 36 class applicability. So that means which customers the rates apply to. Then next, to update the Rate 36 energy charge calculation, which has been a part of the rate all along, but we're just looking at a little bit different way to apply it. And then to implement some risk mitigation measures for the distribution system as well as financial sustainability. So first off is rate applicability. Rates 35 and 36 were adopted in 2016 and 2018. Rate 35 is our high density load rate. And at the time, it was applicable to server farms and similar technological operations. And really, the key point there was that we used an energy use intensity metric, where depending on how much energy was used in the footprint of the operation would determine whether a certain customer was considered a similar technological operation. And that was 250 kilowatt hours per square foot per year. So any customer that exceeded that amount of intense use of energy was considered a Rate 35 customer. In 2018, with the increase in electronic currencies, Bitcoin mining, those things, and then in a rapid influx of customer interest in our area to perform those types of businesses, we implemented Rate 36, which was applicable to computing and data processing specifically related to cryptocurrency and Bitcoin mining. So those are the two rate schedules we currently have. At the bottom of the slide is what we would propose these rate schedules to be applicable for going forward. The first being Rate 35, which would be applicable for loads up to 3 megawatts that still maintain that intense energy use, so the 250 kilowatt hours per square foot per year, but those that are not covered by a more specific rate schedule. And in this case, that more specific rate schedule would be considered Rate Schedule 36, which we would propose to be applicable to all data centers and similar computing loads. So regardless of whether they're doing data hosting, data mining of other sorts, or AI, or Bitcoin mining, or any of those operations would all fall under Rate Schedule 36. Again, up to 3 megawatts for those customers. As far as qualifying Rate 36 customers go, this would include 16 Rate 36 customers. It would also include all data centers and computing loads that are currently served under Rate Schedule 35. And in total, for our customer base, that ends up being 7 services with authorized load of about 9 megawatts. We do have one additional rate or additional customer application in the queue that would also fall into this class. And so the new total rate, total class load for a Rate 36 would be 9.5 megawatts. And that number comes into play a little bit later. So that's why we have pointed it out here. The next area that we looked at for Rate 35 and 36 is the cost recovery component. With the proposal in place, Rate 35, which has a cost of production rate, we would propose no change from the current rate schedule in that case. The only change in Rate 35 is the class applicability that we already talked about, as well as the limit of 3 megawatts. Rate 36, the data centers and similar loads, that would be a new rate title. So instead of cryptocurrency, it would be data centers and similar loads. The basic and demand charges within that rate schedule would stay the same as they currently are, and also the same as they are in Rate 35. The energy component of that rate is where we see changes recommended. In this case, we would recommend a cost of production energy rate for 10 megawatts under that class. And then when or if that class grows above 10 megawatts, then an additional or a calculated energy rate, which would include both that 10 megawatts at cost of production and any additional load over 10 megawatts at a market energy charge. So that would cover the 10 megawatts being a little bit more. It gives that class a little bit more growth above the 9.5 megawatts that it would have right now. But to protect the district, if we saw significant growth like we've had in the past, that market energy charge would start to adjust the rate proportionately from a financial risk perspective.
A question?
Yes.
Does that, would that excess energy above the 10 megawatts, does that come out of our own capacity or is it on the open market? How does that, where does that energy come from?
Maybe, Commissioner, maybe I'll take that one, Eric Walquist. So could be either.
Could be either, but it's not defined in the rate schedule at all?
No, we don't make any commitments about, so we do make our resource mix available about 80%. That's published for all of our rates, but there's no specific sourcing of this one. Gives the district flexibility. The assumption is, and the rate is based upon, in large part, some of those assumptions, that if we get much higher than 10, we will be actually in the market purchasing.
Help me understand that process then. Is that something that you're going to go to the, what's the process around that? That decision making?
We already have that set up. That's up to, I'm going to say, the Power Risk Management Committee at present. Okay. Would make decisions about that in conjunction with the Energy Resources, Energy Planning and Trading Group.
Okay, does the board get informed of that, or is that something that just does internally and moves on?
Typically, just something internally, but we can certainly inform you all if that's what you'd like.
I was just curious. So,
yep, no.
Okay, thank you.
The intent of the rate adjustment, once you get above the 10 megawatts, is to be able to cover that situation that
right.
you're describing in terms of having to go out to the market potentially to purchase that energy.
The rate is calculated the same irrespective of source, but it really isn't. So the reason I said it depends could be either is we can go purchase a block earmarket for these customers, and that's the cost we know. Similarly, we can, let's say we're long
in a
period of time, then we can always, instead of going into the dailies, we can just use our own supply to provide.
Okay, because the concern I have is that we have a kind of a margin, I call it a margin.
Understood.
That we operate 50 to 100 megs, and Is that, I guess, at risk of being consumed without some sort of mitigation in the marketplace?
Yeah, I understand your concern.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks. Sorry.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
It's actually one of the factors that's driving this work.
Thank you.
So for those of us who like numbers, here's another look at the slide that I just talked about as far as rates and authorized loads go. For this particular class, the rate 36 class, when the total authorized load, so that means all of the customers in aggregate that have been authorized to utilize power under rate 36 are added together.
Under 3 megawatts.
Under 3 megawatts. When they're added together, if that total authorized load is 10,000 kilowatts or 10 megawatts or less, the energy rate would be 3.04 cents per kilowatt hour. And this is currently equivalent to rate 35. Rate 35, of course, is on a annual rate increase like all of our other rates are. And so this particular 3.04 cents is current through May 31st of 2024, at which case it would receive the same normal rate increase of our other rates. But so as long as that class remains under 10 megawatts, that's the energy rate for this period of time. Once that class grows to over 10 megawatts, that 3.04 cents per kilowatt hour is blended together with a market energy charge on a ratio basis. So as much additional power over 10 megawatts as there are, that amount of ratio plus the 10 megawatts at 3.04 cents are combined together to create a single blended rate for the entire class. So as the class grows, the rate would adjust for the entire class. So for example, if the total load is 15,000 kilowatts, the energy charge would be the 3.04 cents for 10 15ths or 2/3 of that class, plus the market energy charge for the remaining 5 15ths.
Again,
yes.
Help me understand that. So if we go over, that goes over, it's a blended rate, and if that maintains, let's say, over a period of time, does that blended rate change, or does it just stay that rate?
It changes in two respects. As we add more load, then
the ratio changes because we layer in more energy pricing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it changes annually based upon the market pricing we're seeing.
But it will still be a blended
yes.
rate.
Until the board changes the way that model is calculated by updating the rate in the future, that would be how it is calculated.
And that would trigger by a consistency of a customer taking 15 megawatts, for instance. We would look at that down the road and say, wait a minute.
If the board chose to, yes. If,
or it would come from the staff, I guess the staff.
Yeah, would be, either way. Yeah. Could, this one was in part staff and customer driven. The reason we went through this. But yeah, for certain, any reason at all that the board asks us to, we would evaluate or reevaluate that rate. The rates are purely within the province of the board.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
So while we're not over 10 megawatts at this point, the market energy charge, if we were to calculate it currently, would be 12 cents for the period until May 31st of 2024. And that's calculated based on what we look at in the market, so what our future indexes are telling us. So the average flat mid sea peak and off peak futures as of February 1st for that 12 months that start June 1st. So we all our rate changes occur on June 1st, so we would look at that period, look at what the market energy charge is looking like for that time period on the ICE exchange. Plus a 6% administrative cost, plus 3.1 cents in other energy charges that are related to that market power. So that all goes into that 12 cents. So for in that for that example that we were talking about with the 15 megawatts, we have the 3.04 cents for the 10 15ths, the 12 cents for the 5 15ths. And when we create that average energy rate for the class, it would be 6.03 cents. So that calculation is specified in the rate schedule. The rates themselves will be posted every year when we recalculate on our websites like we currently do.
So the going over the 10 megawatt is not an individual customer-driven number. It's a class-driven number.
That's correct. The class below 3 megawatts. And the reason we keep making that distinction is because it's Lindsay mentioned the proposal is to take anyone above 3 megawatts of load in a location and continue our existing path above 5 megawatts, which is a contract specific. And the way that we've looked at that, at least the proposed way to look at it in the rate schedule, is that we won't know exactly what that customer and those risks or profile looks like until we see them across the table from us. So over 3, we would do an arm's length transaction and an arm's length contract. And then depending upon, I would say, the load, the characteristics, and whatever the risks are, the district can decide whether or not to include that load within the 10% cap or not. So if you had someone at 3.2 that was low risk and had been operating, let's say, for a period of time, we might have them in a contract, but that contract could mirror this rate, or it could be something substantially different, depending upon things like the volume, things like risk, system assets utilized to get the power there, those kinds of things. So above 3, we just retain that flexibility. That's the reason I'm making such a big distinction between 3 and below and above. Sorry about that.
The third part of staff's recommendation is associated with risk mitigation. And we have two parts, operating system as well as financial risk. On the operating system side, as is current with rate 35 and 36, the rate availability area would be limited based on our transmission system capacity. So it generally excludes this class operating availability, say, beyond Leavenworth up in the area of the county where transmission is much more not condensed, limited. Also, new loads are approved only where serving substation capacities do not exceed 70% of the design capacity after the load addition. So what this is intended to protect is the variability of load on our substations. That is a key component in the design of substations, is their ability to have some downtime, some cool-off time. It impacts the aging of transformers and all sorts of different components there. So maintaining that variability in load, because typically rate 35 and rate 36 customers, we typically see all on all the time. So in order to preserve that life of our substations, we wouldn't approve anything over a 70% design capacity.
And I should just say 70% came from the operating groups as our trigger
yes.
point for planning new substations. So that's actually a meaningful threshold that causes action. Sorry.
No, that's great. Thank you. And as Eric's pointed out already here, total load served under this rate schedule may not exceed the 3 megawatts. And we also consider that on a per substation basis, so per customer and per substation. So there's those two, both informed by operations. And then the last item here is associated with interruptibility. We do, of course, have the capability already to interrupt customers in times of system need, but this would create a priority interruptibility for this type of customer, which could mean when we're recovering from an outage, they might be the last customers reconnected, or if we're seeing significant challenges on capacity in, say, the winter or something and need to take any customers out of power, they would be the first to be taken down. And then on the financial side of risk mitigation, we would continue with the upfront capital charges that are currently in place for the system. And then new components in this particular rate schedule would be that the demand charges. So that's your monthly peak demand billed on the KW would be billed at the greater of either the maximum authorized demand or the measured adjusted demand for those services. And then on the energy side, similarly, we would bill at the greater of the actual energy use, or in this case, we would decrease that to 90% of the maximum, which would is what we consider a load factor. So a 90% load factor on those services, which is actually a little bit lower than what we actually see. We see a lot of these customers up in the 95 to 97% load factor type. And then the last item on financial would be that security deposits. So we currently collect security deposits that are 2 times our monthly billed amount. But in this case, we would increase that to 3 times after looking at the various time periods between billing and bill due. And by the time that we would be able to collect payment, we are exposed to 3 months of back payment. So those are risk mitigations recommended. On the financial side. And that is the summary of staff's recommendation. At this point, I'm happy to take questions from the board and then would turn it over to you, Commissioner Smith, for public comment.
Commissioners, questions?
I just have a comment, and that's just that my concern over all of these large loads that come on the system that we don't undermine our, like I said, our operating megawatts that we have that's variable and that it actually provides the benefit to our local customers and keeps our rates low. So that's a real concern of mine. And as long as this rate protects that, I think that's, I'm okay with that. But that's my main concern.
Is it button supposed to be not lit? You want, Kelly, your mic is not on. It right.
Okay. I just stated there's comfort in that the limit for the substation use with the 3 megawatt cap for the class. Okay. Helps address Commissioner Berggren's concern too.
This is just a curiosity question on my part. You may not have it off the top of your head, but somebody will have it rapidly, I'm sure. under this new plan, what would a typical monthly bill for a 3-megawatt load be?
We could take that and give it to
maybe one of our customers.
I see the wheels turning.
We can all sit and watch Lindy do mental math. if you'll allow us, we can happily take that.
Okay.
And share it with anybody who might call to ask.
Well, similar, Commissioner Berger and I think asked Andrew Grizel that, and he was just like, I had to double check him because he responded way too fast.
Yeah.
he was in the
ballpark. That's all I'm asking is a ballpark number. I'm not holding it.
I can give you a ballpark.
Thanks for checking into that.
Yeah. Yeah. And before I open it to public comment, any other commissioner?
I have more of a comment than I think.
I just want to add one thing. So the 3 months of security deposit. So that's actually an up to 3 months. 3 months being the default, with flexibility to depart downward from that, depending upon, I'm going to say the risk you present, the customer, your customer history, behavior, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So we just stated it as 3 months, and I just want to make sure you understand it's actually up to 3 months.
Okay.
That is the default, but there is some flexibility to depart, which already exists, by the way. We're not changing that.
Okay.
Thank you. Having just a comment, really.
Okay.
Having been the immediate past president of the Washington State PUD Association, I sat in on many, many conversations about the transition of the utility as it relates to electric utilities across not just the state of Washington, but the entire Northwest, and for that matter, the entire United States. Electrification is coming. Our state is leading the charge with Governor Inslee putting in some legislation that impacts starting this year with electrification of homes, removal of gas appliances, and we see on the horizon electrification of the transportation sector, both mass transit and individual homeowner vehicles. So on the horizon is an increased demand for electricity. Now this is being met at the same time simultaneously with a reduction of capacity, where coal-operated generation is being taken offline, natural gas generation is being taken offline, and the significance of that is that both coal, gas, and hydro have immediate capacity, whereas when you look at the alternatives of solar and wind, it's an intermittent supply. Intermittent meaning you will only get power when the sun's out, and when the wind blows. So during the rest of the time, you have to have demand capacity, which would be hydro, which would be coal, which is coming offline, as I said, and gas. So reduction in capacity, increase in demand, and all having to be timed rather perfectly if this is going to be successful. And if it's not, then you have all kinds of problems in the system. So as a utility that is looking to the future of change, dramatic change for that matter, I feel that taking these kinds of steps with the implementation of Rate 36, already having Rate 35, what it does is it smooths out some of that transitory change that we're seeing that's going to be taking place in the very near future. So I am a supporter of this Rate 36, simply because there's a lot of unknown as we move forward. We're trying to make sure that we can level it out as much as possible, and this is just one step forward in trying to level that and having more visibility as we go forward into this changing world. Thank you.
Oh, just to dovetail on what
before we get to more, if I'd known that was. That's a board discussion. So we want to do board discussion after public comment, for the most part. So just a thought.
Well, I'm just speaking to this because, you know, we're talking about, you know, adjusting this rate 36, and I think it has our inflow certainty, I guess, on how we manage our power in the river probably has something to do with this down the road and how we, you know, service these rates. And so I'm just going to throw that out as something that maybe in the future we need to start looking at as well, not just rate structure, but also on how we manage our water and through our dams. So okay. That's it.
So if there's no more questions for Lindsay, I'd like to open it for public comment and remind any members of the public present if they would come to the mic and give their name and address for the record, because we do record these, and attempt to limit your comments to 3 minutes. I would open it for public comment.
Hello, Daniel Conover, 203 Mission Avenue in Kashmir, and that is about $75,000 a month.
Thank you.
Three times our bill. Be straightforward and easy. I just want to make sure that you guys have thought about the community and the expansion of technology out in the Wenatchee Valley. I've been here for 10 years. I actually sat in this room back in 2016 when we did this the first time around. We have now, just off our small site, we have 18 employees. Our payroll's grown to just north of $1 million a year. L&I tax, we pay $16,000. Employment security, we're $26,941, $258,000 sales tax to Kashmir, $37,000 per year. Honestly, because of what happened in 2016, we expanded out into Boise, Idaho, and Birmingham, Alabama, and now we are growing in Arkansas. And, you know, it's kind of sad to see that we can't really do this further in the Wenatchee Valley. I'm not saying that you guys aren't building a rate that, you know, is unsustainable for you guys. You guys have to make sure, obviously, that you're protecting the capacity and things like that. But the question that I have for you guys is, I see on there that you have market rate energy. So I'm used to working with like MISO and things like that down in Arkansas, and when I hear market rate, I think of the fluctuation every 15 minutes in the price of energy. And then I see market rate, and then I see a flat price. When you guys talk market rate, are you guys just getting a hedged power price yourself, or are you guys actually getting market rate off Hub C?
I would have to defer to,
if you have an answer.
I don't have a specific, if we're getting it off of Mitzi, but it would not be a rate that changes on the 15 minute or daily. We would take a look at the forward market and take an average of those.
Okay.
Prices.
So you guys essentially are like a hedge price coming in. Would a customer have access to buying it directly off market like Microsoft is doing?
That would be a discussion that the district would have, probably most likely in the over 3 megawatt situations where we talk about contracts.
Gotcha. And I'm actually not saying that our company is going to be expanding here. What I'm talking about is kind of the broader community and things like that, because, you know, as we move in toward 2030 and beyond, we're going to become a more energy dependent society. And, you know, this is an extraordinarily unique environment, especially for computing. It's nice and chilly, especially today in the summer. You know, obviously we do have hot days, and it's clean. I mean, it's clean power. You know, where we're at operating in Arkansas, it's not. We're trying to help them build nuclear and things like that, but there's a lot of benefits to the Wenatchee Valley. And what I don't want to see happen is a rate gets put together that makes people not invest in this community any further. And maybe that's needed to slow things down, but, you know, I just want to make sure that you guys obviously have talked about that, understand that, you know, see that we have a small operation and we've grown to the size we have. I guess I'm not really asking questions. I'm up here making comments.
So
I apologize for that.
If I understand you correctly, based on the comment you made about the 75,000, you're at about a megawatt.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And you have 20 employees?
We have 18.
18 employees.
And we would grow. There's just too much risk from a business perspective. I see 6 cents, and I can be on ERCOT for 3.4 all in after everything. I'm on MISO at 4.3. If you're not talking about data centers, if you're actually, this is my team here, we're actually very averse into both HPC and crypto mining. 6.8 cents is the hosted rate. And hosting is the, you're putting something in someone else's apartment, right? And so I don't have to build a facility. I don't have to do anything. I can just 6.8 cents. I can go send my equipment somewhere and they're going to take care of everything. The CapEx, all the operations. So I see what I know about energy throughout the country is, this is completely pricing out based on other market factors. And maybe that is the goal. Maybe the goal is no more investment into technology businesses in Wenatchee. But what I want to make sure isn't happening is that the small to medium customers aren't just completely negated away. You know, I don't want to see just the Microsofts, the Googles being the only one that you guys are thinking about. Because it's been a 10-year journey for us, and I like living here. It's nice.
Okay.
It's a great place to be.
Thank you.
Commissioners, just for clarity, I just want to note that how and from what source and of what quality the power that will serve Microsoft, at least in Chelan County, is not determined. We don't have an agreement with Microsoft about that present.
Okay. Additional public comment.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Mm-hmm. My name is Malachi Salcedo, Salcedo Group, 615. Suite C-1, North Wenatchee Avenue. I wanted to say congratulations to Commissioner Allen.
Thank you.
We haven't met before, but welcome aboard. Congratulations. Thank you for serving. Commissioner Bergeron.
Yeah, nice to see you again.
Yeah, it's good to see you again. Welcome back. Thinking about the Welcome Back, Cotter theme song.
I hear that in my head all the time.
I just have a couple quick comments. This is our third rate process with a PUD in the last 12 months. So we've been through a very similar rate rethinking process based on all of the massive energy market changes that are happening, both with Grant County PUD and with Douglas County PUD. And so there are some common themes. Wise commissioners in all three public utility districts are making similar moves, very specifically to protect against market rate risk. That's wise. What I want to say is thank you to commissioners and staff because you spend a lot of time doing this over and over again, and you don't have to. You could have stopped two rate adjustments ago and just said, that's it, deal with it. But you continue to be responsive and ask for comment and consider it and work through the process to try to address market rate risk and also address the needs of the customer base. So I thank you for that because that's a lot harder than just setting a price that completely protects against market rate risk and then calling it good and moving on. So thank you. Thanks for taking the time. Something tells me this won't be the last time we do this. So until next time, much appreciated.
Thank you. Any additional public comment? Hearing none, additional board discussion and board input for staff.
I appreciate your comments. You're absolutely right. This is trying to balance a lot right now. And so I have not, this is my first time. I'm so lucky, but I have been present at previous meetings and conversations. And while these rates will impact many people, I do feel that they're necessary to be making these adjustments so that we can hedge moving forward. So thank you to our team for all the work you've done.
Okay. No, I've said that. Well,
input, next steps.
Great. Thank you, Commissioners. No decision day, obviously. I just want to echo Commissioner Allen's comments. I said it last time, but I really mean it. I owe a great debt of thanks to the team that worked on this. It's a very large team from a lot of disciplines. Some really smart people and some extraordinary subject matter experts put a lot of time into this, and they did that while they're also putting a lot of time into a lot of the other very important projects that you all hear about. So to those on the team, my personal thanks and appreciation.
All right, so next steps, we will review and evaluate the comments. The comment period does remain open until the board's next board meeting. So if anyone listening who hears about this later would like to submit written comments, we do accept those as well. And we'll provide the board a summary of that at our next meeting. We will prepare resolution pending any other direction otherwise from the board. But of course, at every meeting and every decision, you have the choice to defer to a later meeting. So unless there are other comments, until next time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks,
thank
Lindsay.
You. Thanks, Lindsay. Commissioners, the next item on the agenda is our consent agenda, which we modified this morning to include resolution number 13. Is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
I so move.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that we approve the consent agenda as modified. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. Now we're on to the regular agenda and resolution number 12.
Okay, I'd like to invite Chad Rissman up. This is a resolution declaring TPC Wire and Cable Corporation of Macedonia, Ohio as the sole source supplier of Supertrex type SH medium voltage power cable for the mobile substation contract number 23-12951.
Thank you, Kirk. Good afternoon, Commissioners. As Kirk said, I'd like you to consider sole source name justification for this cable, and it fits on a very specific cable trailer. So a little bit of background on this. There's a budget line item this year for this purchase. We have four mobile substations. We have two cable trailers, and we utilize those cable trailers when the mobile substations are being deployed. Because of a lot of things you keep hearing about, we are deploying those mobile substations in ways we never imagined before, trying to keep equipment and transformers and things going, longer lead times item. They're seeing more of them are they're in service longer. And there were several times over the last couple of years that I look out because my trailer office looks out where we park these, and there's none of them there. None. So we have four, and they're all deployed. So we're using these a lot more than what we expected to. And so we put in a budget line item for another cable trailer. This is the way that we connect up these things to our substations. And the cable that we received with the other two mobiles, it's a mining cable. It's very flexible. It's very unique and specific. Sounds like other people hook their mobiles up in slightly different ways. We really like this way. We have these trailers on the other two. We sought out developing functional specifications for things and keep coming back to this one manufacturer who we've ended up with. Like I said, it comes on a trailer, specific trailer for the cable. You can train it off with hydraulics, and they've got a really great setup. Functionally describing that, we're going to end up at that same manufacturer. So we're hoping we get some support buying a third one that matches the other two. We have great experience with the other two that we have in service. Going through the process of this, too, they've also declared that there's nowhere else we can get this cable. So it is that unique. So thank you for your consideration. Any questions?
Questions, Commissioners?
I'd just like to make a comment.
Okay.
Looking back on our purchase of the two mobile trailers, I am so glad we did that when we did prior to supply chain issues, and we're able to order them and actually have them arrive and in a timely manner. That was really good. Good timing.
Yeah, thank you for your support on that. I'm glad we did. And we're using, like I said, we're using those things in ways we didn't expect to use them before. So we've got a couple of transformers that we're watching. Transformers now, after our contract is depleted, looks like they're going from 1 year out to 3+ years out.
Wow.
So we don't carry spares. Our spares are our mobile substations. So we're going to have to rely on those in a different way. And so appreciate the support for those.
Based on what you just said and knowing that we're continuing to add substations, and we've got 45 or so substations, is it time to revisit the thought process of not having spares?
That conversation is coming up in different forums also related to security and some of the security things. And so security, having things on hand quicker. So I think you're probably going to end up seeing something like that when we start putting together the next contract. The latter part of this year, maybe into next year, for the next several transformers that we buy. So thank you for that comment. Definitely keep that in mind.
Yeah.
It's a precursor.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, earlier today we learned about driving in multi-lane roundabouts. Those mobile substations, I went on a ride along and talk about trying to get one of those through even the smaller the roundabout, the harder it is because of the turning radius. But we have some amazing employees that can actually do that. It's pretty remarkable. Wow. But talk about a big challenge just to get one of those around a roundabout. Yeah. Yeah. So anything we can do to make their job easier is a good thing.
Yes.
All right, I'd like to invite David Lodge up for agenda item 14. This is a resolution ratifying field work order change order number 31 and further approving field work order change order number 32 for the Service Center project with Absher Construction Company of Puyallup, Washington for construction of the Service Center project pursuant to General Contractor Construction Manager GCCM contract number 18-91. I sympathize with Commissioner Allen.
Just rolls right
just
off.
Just so you know, I don't actually draft those myself.
Yeah. Rebecca.
No, she. No, her either.
No, Eric is lying.
I'm more to blame than Rebecca.
Welcome, Dave.
Well, I don't have much after that. So, high level field work order change order 31 was executed in the amount of $321,025. And includes various construction changes. One significant change was addressing communication between building systems and district controlled network. So this required additional cabling and equipment, but allows for alarming of critical building systems to our system operations center. The rest of the change order included various other changes that are itemized in the resolution. And presenting field work order change order 32 today, proposed in the amount of $1,459,408. And this includes trade contractor claims resulting from district direction to stop ground disturbing activities due to cultural resources. This change order includes costs for general conditions, material cost escalation, labor rate increase, labor inefficiencies, and other related expenses from trade contractors performing the following work: rebar, roofing and siding, glazing, ceilings, and HVAC controls. So this change order resolves all of the remaining trade contractor cultural claims with the exception of the electrical contractor construction manager, which has been partially settled under field work order change order 26. The change orders 31 and 32 increase the total contract to $123,148,480. Both of these change orders are funded from project contingency within the approved project budget. Any questions?
None here. Questions?
No.
Can I just say something? I just have a lot of comments today, sorry. But I'm just, when you set out to do a project, it doesn't matter whether you're building a house or doing a remodel. You do it based on the best assumptions that you have at the time and the visibility that's available. Who in the world would have thought we would have COVID and we would have supply chain issues hit us in the middle of a major construction project like we were doing? And even if somebody had envisioned that, who would have envisioned that the process of delay would have been as significant as it would have? And it's as I have certainly come to appreciate, construction projects, particularly big ones, are really a ballet. If you've got one contractor coming in and they've got a job to do, their slot into a certain time frame, and as soon as they leave, another contractor comes in, and you interrupt that ballet and throws off everybody. And that's exactly what we ended up experiencing. So I am pleasantly surprised and very impressed, actually, that you guys, the staff, everybody here, has been so successful and their ability to get this job to this point of completion is absolutely impressive. So no matter what obstacles were thrown in front of you, everybody did a wonderful job. So hear, hear.
Thank you very much.
You know, Gary, you always stimulate me worldwide today more than other. But so I will comment on this and the fact that one of the things that I think is really critical when this project was started, of course, I wasn't here when all of it started. It's already ongoing. But I was there for a little bit of it at the beginning. And I'm so appreciative of the board and the staff and how you went forward creating this reserve fund that we have that it was substantial. It's a way of saying that, you know, we're invested in this and we're going to protect our investment as we move forward, because none of these projects ever actually come out to what we are predicting to be or they're estimated to be. There's always contingencies and things, and we certainly have had enough on this project. But I do have to, applaud the board and the staff and everybody for having the foresight to go forward with a contingency reserve that we're able to tap into and apply those dollars and assets to this building, knowing that we were going to have things like this happen, and also in a way that doesn't tax the customers in any way, shape, or form. These are dollars that are already set aside for this project, so it doesn't affect anybody. It's money well spent. It's going to make a better project. It takes a little of the pressure off as we move forward, and knowing that we have those dollars in place and that we've protected the rate payer as well. And so my compliments are to everyone that's in this room and the people that worked to do that, because I saw just the beginning of where we were going, and you guys have done it. A great job, because this is a monumental project that it's a big deal, and so thank you, and that it shows just some of the teamwork that we've all had here. I guess you guys work together, and so I just want to recognize that in a small way. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
You know, Gary, you did stimulate the juices amongst a couple of us. One of the things that hit me when Gary was talking is he didn't even mention the one I think is the really big hang-up that caused the ballet you had to do, and that was the cultural artifact finds, because that, I mean, we had to deal with all of those issues right at the same time COVID was hitting. And so, I mean, and the other thing that Gary just made me think of is when he mentioned ballet, it was you in a tutu. I just don't know what that would look like.
I bet Tracy Yunt could help arrange that.
Well, I will be back.
Okay, but great job. Thank you. We're getting close.
We are very close.
Yes.
Thanks, David.
Can I say one last thing? I think it's only fair for the benefit of folks that might be listening to the recording today to really clarify. And this was something that you had said, Carmen.
Here we go. So
I'm taking from you. But it's important to acknowledge that this project is completely self-funded.
Yeah.
So
So there's no debt. We didn't sell bonds. We're not going to raise customer rates to build this building. And the reserve fund that Karn is talking about was money that the board saw fit to put aside in a fund specifically for dealing with the setbacks, the COVID, the supply chain issues. We knew there was going to be an impact. We weren't sure how big of an impact. And so additional funds were set aside for that purpose. So there'll be no negative outcome from this. And as I have talked with other PUDs around the state who are also contemplating having a new service center built, my advice to each of them as they've sought out advice because we are building one was to take your time and save money. Put money in the bank. Create this reserve account. Don't go at it without having money, sufficient funds set aside. And I think if I have to applaud my fellow commissioners, I would say that was a step that was embraced by the board and by my fellow commissioners as the proper steps before we ever broke ground. And so I just think that made all the difference in the world given the adversity that we hit along the way. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Run. Thank you. Yeah, run.
One more thing.
So, commissioners, we have resolutions 12 and 14 to take action on. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve resolutions 12 and 14. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. Manager items.
We finished that one this morning.
Okay. Commissioner travel.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Rebecca Newman, Clerk of the Board, here filling in for Lisa to review your upcoming travel. A few meetings to review. September 13th through 15th in Richland is the monthly WAPUTA meetings, and I have made hotel reservations for Commissioners Bergeron and McKenna. Also for Commissioner Arsenault, although on the form here it says he had to stay elsewhere, but I was able to get him into the room block at the event hotel, so that'll be updated for next time. September 14th through the 15th as well, Commissioner Allen is heading to visit Power X in Vancouver, so she's all ready to go there. And then September 27th through the 29th is the upcoming WAPUTA Water Workshop in Sequim. And so I've got a hotel reserved for Commissioner Smith arriving on the 26th, departing on the 29th. Commissioner Allen, were you planning to attend that as well?
Please.
Okay, do you want to arrive the same date, the 26th?
Yes, please.
I'm going to check to see how long it takes to get there because that starts at 1 o'clock.
And 5 hours.
It takes 5 hours? Okay, leave it the same.
Okay. How about you? Does that change your change your mind on anything?
The 26th is good.
Okay. Then you can take your leisurely time to get there on the 26th. Other than that, I didn't go any farther forward than that, but I'm happy to take any direction you have on future meetings.
There's on this September 13th, 15th, I have a personal issue there that may conflict with that date.
Okay. Let me just hold off on registering you.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Okay. And I think I'll be able to make thank you for bringing that back up. I have not registered anyone for that meeting. The registration isn't quite open yet, but I'll.
Right. I mean, there's a chance, but no, that's the.
Why don't I go ahead and cancel it? And if you need to add it back in later, we can.
It's just some family health issues.
No worries.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Rebecca, would you go ahead and sign me up for the October 19th budget committee meeting. I will attend in Olympia.
Yes, I will.
Thank you.
I'm assuming you want to arrive the day before on the 18th.
I'm not clear on what time that meeting is. If it's in the afternoon, I can leave the same day.
I'll check.
Okay.
Okay. Good for the moment. All right. Commission items. Do we have any commissioner items? I see the one that we need to set up a
board workshop meeting date, but any other commissioner items before we get to that?
What do you mean before we get to that?
Are we getting there now? Yeah, we're at commission items, and I figured before doing the motion on the board workshop, I'd
say, awesome.
Commissioners, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I just wanted to share that Karnan and I both met with Port Commissioner Duroc and County Commissioner Tiffany Gehring, and it was really fun. Commissioner Duroc had arranged for a tour of Pangbourne, and so they hosted us, did a slideshow of all their upcoming projects, and including renovations at the airport. And of course, they did let us know that for the second flight, that there is a minimum commitment of the, was it $500,000 per year that they will be seeking contributions for. There wasn't a specific ask, but that did seem to be a big part of it. And they did include lunch. It was a nice
was very nice
Friday,
yeah.
Right? That's all I really have to share.
I'll just dovetail on that. It was enlightening. These meetings between the commissioners and the port, you know, all of this is really beneficial as far as, you know, information sharing. They shared extensively what their path forward was and the projects that they have involved with in economic growth around the airport. And one thing just comes back in diamonds when I hear this talk, and that each time they talk about creating jobs, we also got to create housing in some place for people to live. This is going to be a major, major thing looking forward in this valley and Douglas, and I think Wenatchee, is how are we going to address the housing situation, because we're already underwater. And we're going to continue to get that, and that affects how we do things and how people either migrate to this area or, you know, support their families. So affordable housing is critical. We need all kinds of housing, frankly, in order to support this growth that we're going to have. And so one of the things I'm focusing on, and it just keeps coming back, is how are we going to address this? And as one part, one small part of this county, and how we move forward with infrastructure and development, we need to seriously have a conversation of how we're going to move forward, so we're not hindering the ability for growth. It's not going to go away. We don't need to bury our heads in the sand. This is the way it is. This is real time. It's happening right now, and so I think that we really need to start. Looking at alternate way or other ways of how we can be successful in being part of the solution in this thing. And I'm not saying we're part of the problem, but we need to modernize the way we think and say, how do we solve problems in the most efficient manner, working with the other entities involved, the port, the county, all that. I think we really need to come together as a community and say, hey, how are we going to move forward with this, this in this new era? I mean, we've got lots of challenges. To me, it's exciting to be able to talk about it and say how we're going to look at the future of our community. So thank you, Kelly. Kelly does a tremendous amount of organizing these things. I'm not big on organizing and setting the agenda, but she's done a lot, and she's drugged me along also with employee employee recognition, not drug me, but I've gone. No, I shouldn't have said that, but I willingly participating in something that I don't necessarily think of all the time. And she's done a great job in for employee recognition, and I want to give her some compliments on that.
Oh, thank you.
Because we're nothing but positive feedback. Nothing. I mean, absolutely 100% positive feedback on what we're doing. So thank you, Kelly.
And we learn a lot from
them. Oh, tremendous. There's a tremendous learning possibilities here, talking to the employees and how much they appreciate where they live and where they work. And so, you know, communication lines are open. You know, let's talk. We're all part of the same team. So, thanks.
What was also fascinating at the port presentation was when they were revealing the tax revenue from the data centers. I had no idea. And Costco was the top one as far as the revenue, not from their retail, but from their data center. So clueless. It didn't even dawn on me that they had their own data center here locally. So the data centers are definitely here to stay. So thank you. It was worthwhile.
Yep. Super. Any other commission items? We are in need of setting a board workshop date. There's a motion, a proposed motion. Do I have a volunteer to put the motion on the table?
I propose to set a special meeting on Wednesday, October 4th, 2023 at 9 a.m. at Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Center Way, Wenatchee, for the purpose of holding a board workshop.
Is there a second?
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded to hold our board workshop. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is carried. We have follow-up on delegation of action items from the previous meetings.
Yep, we have one. Eric was going to provide the current rate 36 demand exceedance charge, which he did on the same day, July 24th, by email.
Okay.
And nothing new from today's
meeting. Nothing new from today. Any additional public comment? I don't see any public. Any other matters that necessarily come before us before we go into executive session? Hearing none, after a short break, 5-minute break, I will take us into an executive session to discuss with legal counsel, agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs, and to review the performance of a public employee as authorized by the RCWs for approximately 2 hours. Well, that one additional item to be discussed in executive session is the minimum price for which real estate may be offered for sale.
Pursuant to the statute. Yep.
Pursuant to the statute.
Thank you.
It is now 10 minutes until 5. At 4:15, we came out of executive session and added an additional 30 minutes. Evidently, the microphone did not pick it up. We are now coming out of executive session. No votes were taken. No decisions were made. And is there any other business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we stand adjourned.